yo, check this out, man.
For a minute that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff. Who, you know, the only way you cure that, death, bloodshed. I don't advocate it, but I see that it's really the only answer.
Gonna rise up, take what's there. 'Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talk about a revolution.
This week in radical history for the week starting August 4th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found in the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the east side.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
As reported in the San Francisco Herald on this date, August 4th, 1869, San Francisco land speculator Emperor Norton I declares the United States dissolve, and the greatest and wise ruler of the United States abolishes both Democratic and Republican parties. He's quoted in the paper as saying, "Party strife now exists within the realm. I do hereby dissolve and abolish Democratic and Republican parties, and also do hereby decree the disfranchisement and imprisonment for not more than 10 years and no less than 5 years to all persons leading to any violation of this your imperial decree." So remember, when you go out and vote Democrat or Republican this coming year, you're going to be in violation of the emperor's decree. Wouldn't want to do that now. In other empire news, in 1925 on this date, U.S. Marines leave Nicaragua after 13 years of occupation. Don't worry, they'll be back again and again. Also on August 4, 1944, Netherlands, Nazi police in Amsterdam, acting on an informant's tip, discover Anne Frank and the family in hiding. The eight lived in a single secret room for 728 days, then were sent to the notorious Belsen concentration camp where they were killed except the father. He returned to the house after the war and found Anne's diary. Began at age 12, he recorded the feelings and thoughts, pressures and fears, while coming to age during 2 years of hiding from death. Translated in over 30 languages is a symbol of strength and how brutal humans can be to other humans. People, the time has
come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Jackie Cook. On this day, August 4th, in 1964, the bodies of American civil rights activists James Chaney, Michael Schwerner, and Andrew Goodman were found in the Mississippi River after disappearing 2 months earlier. The three young activists had traveled together to Mississippi to register black voters and investigate the bombing of a black church. After being arrested for supposed speeding, they were released onto a dark, remote road and greeted by carloads of Ku Klux Klan members. The Klansmen shot the two Jewish New Yorkers, Schwerner and Goodman. Chaney, a black Mississippi native, was brutally beaten with chains and mutilated before being shot. The killings received massive media attention and ignited public sympathy, but civil rights activists criticized the publicity, stating that had two of the victims not been white, the case would have been largely ignored. Can you think of any other cases like this? Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Lastly, on August 4th, 1988, Congress votes 20,000 each Japanese Americans in turn during World War II. This week in radical history for August 5th, 1498. What? No kangaroos? Columbus is the first recent European to land in South America continent, and he thinks he landed in Australia. Speaking of colonization in the New World, in this date in 1620, the Mayflower and Speedwell sail away and also do not find Australia. Unfortunately, if you're Native American, they find them instead. Also on August 5th, 1892, Harriet Tubman gets a pension from Congress for her work as a nurse, spy, and scout during the Civil War. She, along with Sojourn Truth and Susie King, and almost 200 other African-American women, served as nurses during the war in 11 hospitals in over three states. Also on August 5, 1936, James Colton, who married anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman in 1925 to provide her with British citizenship, dies of cancer. Colton, an elderly anarchist from Wales, married Emma so she'd be free from the problems of traveling and giving lectures. Also on this date, 1964, U.S. begins bombing of North Vietnam to protect American interests, of course.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
Also on August 5th, 1990, Bush sends U.S. Marines into Liberia to protect American interests.
And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality.
This Week in Radical History for August 6th, 1855, Bloody Monday riots. A Louisville, Kentucky mob pulling a brass cannon attacks Irish Quarter, burning down houses and killing at least 20, the Irish being the Mexicans of our day. Also on August 6, 1890, on Good Friday, of course, the first electric chair execution in the United States happens in Auburn Prison in New York. It was a gruesome execution. It had to be done over and over again. And no, he did not rise in 3 days. Also on August 6, 1927, Massachusetts High Court hears final plea for those anarchist bastards, Sutko and Vizzetti. Protest bombs hit homes of Baltimore mayor and Boston mayor. Their controversial trial attracted numerous international attention, with critics accusing the prosecution and presiding judge of improper conduct, like calling them those anarchist bastards, and allowing of anti-Italian, anti-immigrant, and anti-anarchist sentiment to prejudice the jury. Prominent Americans such as Upton Sinclair publicly sided with the citizen-led opposition to the verdict. The two executed elicited mass protests in New York, London, Amsterdam, Tokyo. Workers walked out across South America, and riots in Paris, Geneva, and Germany, as well as Johannesburg, occurred. Also on August 6, 1945, U.S. drops atomic bomb on a civilian population of Hiroshima, U.S. being the only country to use this massive type of WMD. Destroying homes of almost 400,000 people, the bomb explodes in the air and destroys more than two-thirds of the city's buildings. About half the population is burned in ruins, burned to death by the explosive heat or consumed by fire. Thousands of survivors develop radiation sickness, and in 1 month, hundreds more would die in makeshift hospitals and other weakened buildings crumble around them. There is no practical reason to drop the bomb. It did nothing to shorten the war, and Japan was already trying to negotiate peace with the United States. The United States is simply determined to show Russia who is calling a tune in the post-World War. Also on August 6, 1957, 11 activists from the Committee of Nonviolence Action arrested at Atomic Test Proving Grounds in Nevada, the first of what eventually become thousands arrested in Nevada test site and hundreds of thousands around the world. Also on that date, 1967, Indian Claims Commission awards $12.2 million to 8 Lakota tribes for 29 million acres, most of them in the Upper Great Plains, taken by fraudulent treaties. Also on that date, 1985, USSR begins unilateral moratorium on nuclear testing. U.S. responds by conducting more underground nuclear tests. Then in 1989, the U.S. expressed moral outrage at India and Pakistan for similar testing. Also on August 6, 1988, Tompkins Square Park police riot in New York. A videotape of the police riot got five cops indicted, the chief retired, the captain moved out of the ninth precinct, and more cops were disciplined and some fired. Lastly on this date, in 1990, U.N. Security Council imposed economic sanctions in Iraq. Total deaths of children under age 5 from the cause of sanctions from 1990 to November 1999 was 502,495 deaths of children. This Week in Radical History for August 7th, 1854. Rumor that all Catholic churches were arsenals brings a mob of axe-wielding Protestants to St. Louis House of Worship. 8 Irish were butchered like cattle and 30 more seriously wounded, the Irish being the Mexicans of our day. Also on August 7, 1960, Fidel Castro announces plans to nationalize all American holdings. U.S. and the Mafia, which controlled the economy, fights back. And U.S. government takes the moral high ground and begins a nonstop campaign to assassinate Fidel Castro. Also on his date, 1967, Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, in response to a falsely report of attacks, U.S. destroyer passes the House 416-0 and the Senate 88-2. Giving LGB extraordinary powers, authorizing him to use all necessary steps to win the war in Vietnam. Only two legislatures, Morris and Running, vote against it, with no opposition in the House. Then the FBI begins collecting the names of supporters of Morris, and his office phone lines are tapped. Same war, different year. Also on that date, 1978, the Love Canal subdivision, Niagara Falls, New York, built on a site of former Harker Chemical Company chemical dump, formally declared a toxic disaster area by President Carter. Also on this date, 1979, highly enriched uranium released from a top-secret nuclear fuel plant near Irwin, Tennessee. About 1,000 people are contaminated with up to 5 times as much radiation they would normally receive in any given year. Lastly, for August 7, 1995, due to international pressure, State of Pennsylvania announces the stay of its planned August 17th, execution of political prisoner Mumia Ajamil. U.S. officials have vowed to silence Mumia at all costs and take extraordinary actions to do so. NPR buckles under the pressure from the right wing. Temple University in Philadelphia, owners of seven Pennsylvania radio stations, also buckles under pressure, refused to air tapes in defense of him, cancels contract with Pacifica Network. Free press? Yeah. This week in radical history for August 8th, 1449. Portuguese slaver Henry the Navigator unloads six ship of human cargo slaves from Africa. He proclaims it is the, quote, salvation, unquote, of their souls. Also on August 8th, 1879, Mexico, revolutionary hero anarchist Emilio Zapata lives. He'll inspire the Zapatista movement. Zapata will continue to live as long as the people believe that they have the right to their own lands and the right to govern themselves according to their own deeply held beliefs and cultural values. Also on August 8, 1925, a huge KKK rally held in Washington, D.C. The modern-day KKK, known as skinheads, with all the right-wing anti-immigrant sentiment, skinheads are increasing in numbers around the United States and the world. Also on this date, 1942, India National Congress passes Quit India Resolution, leading to mass arrests by their British masters. Two more items for August 8, 1974. Tricky Dick Nixon, no longer claiming he is a crook, announces he'll resign. Said, "I am not a quitter." Then he quits. Also claimed during the Vietnam War to be a pacifist. Guess he got that one wrong, too. Also on that date, 1980, Reagan aide William Casey leaves on his second trip to bribe Iranians to delay the release of U.S. hostage until Reagan takes office. Only got a couple items in this week in radical history for August 9th, 1779. General Clinton and 1,500 American troops break dam and flood the Iroquois towns and fields in upstate New York. Troops then burn and ravage settlement for 12 days. Also on that date, 1945, America Fat Boy dropped on Nagasaki. About 70,000 more civilians die immediately. Truman drops the bomb to prove to Russia that he's tough and gets the Cold War arms race off to an unhealthy start. Also on August 6, 1966, 200 sit-in in New York City's offices of Dow Chemical Company to protest the use of napalm in Vietnam. Edward Abbey would say, "A patriot must always be ready to defend his country against his government." Lastly, for August 9, 1997, New York City cops rape and torture Abner Louima, a legal immigrant from Haiti, sodomizing with a plunger. New York cops always practice their own unique form of justice. This week in radical history for August 10th, only got a couple items. 1877, U.S. Army troops under Colonel Gibson attack a sleeping Nez Perce encampment at Big Hole, Idaho, killing over 50 women and children. Also on August 10th, 1893, Chinese are deported from San Francisco under the first Chinese Exclusion Act to exclude Chinese workers from the United States. The Chinese being Irish of that day, the Chinese and Irish being the Mexicans of our day. 1968, eight American GIs killed by U.S. strafing error in Vietnam. Quote, "Vietnam was the first war ever fought without censorship of the media. Without censorship, things can go terribly confusing in the public mind," unquote. General William Westmoreland, U.S. military commander. Lastly, on this date, 1981, the closing of the Nixon Museum, says manager Pete Mitchell. Quote, "If nothing else, it's been a good stopping point for people to use the restrooms between Los Angeles and San Diego." This has been This Week in Radical History. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, thanks to some audio borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York, and more radical info came from the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. Thanks for listening to this week's This Week in Radical History, produced at the Glee Glee Studios. And as always, until next week, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
A voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, "God, I voted."
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fahm and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we take another long look at the Palestinian right of return, a right carved in international law that is non-negotiable in any kind of proposed settlement between Palestine and Israel. And like our Bill of Rights, guarantees rights which extend to the individual. You are about to hear excerpts from a forum at the Right of Return Conference held at the NYU Law School a few months ago. It begins with an introduction of both the issue and the speakers.
I want to start by thanking NYU Students for Justice in Palestine, as well as all the co-sponsors for this event, Palestine Works, the Center for Human Rights and Social Justice here at the law school, the student chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, as well as Law Students for Human Rights, for really facilitating this very important conversation. I think the right of return is often not discussed, and it remains one of the most fraught issues that is really at the heart of the current dispute. For Palestinians, the right of return represents a core right. And for many, this conflict will not be resolved until you deal with the reality today, where Palestinian refugees are denied the right to return to their ancestral homeland, while the law of return in Israel allows members of the Jewish community in the United States or in any other country to move to Israel and to become citizens on the spot. Whereas for Israelis, for many Israelis, the right of return represents a political question, a non-starter, and a threat to the existential identity of the state. And as Aman alludes to as well, we deal with a situation where Palestinian refugees represent actually a number larger than the population of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So while so much discussion focuses on the situation in the occupied territories, the reality remains that unless you have a viable, sustainable solution for the Palestinian refugee crisis, you will not ever fully resolve this question. So it's an important conversation, but thankfully we have a really incredible group of people here today to discuss it. So starting to my immediate left, we have Emilio David, who is a Palestine Law Fellow at Columbia University Center for Palestine Studies during the current year. He's also the Director of International Law and the Human Rights Program at Al-Quds University, and his work aims to shed light on the role that judicial phenomenon play in social and anthropological questions, and more specifically on the disciplinary powers of law and the discourse of human rights in contemporary colonial Palestine. Emilio will be speaking second in addressing the PA's legislation and policy around the right of return. To Emilio's left, we have, of course, Jamil Dakhwar, who is director of the ACLU's human rights program, where he oversees human rights research, documentation, advocacy, and litigation before international human rights bodies. Before joining the ACLU, Jamil was with Human Rights Watch, and he previously worked at Adala, who, as I'm sure is familiar to many in the room, a very prominent organization. And he has filed and argued human rights cases before Israeli courts and international fora. To Jamil's left, we have Michael Litwin, a lifelong activist. Michael is a public defender in Brooklyn, former president of the Association of Legal Aid Attorneys in UAW Local 2325, and co-founder of Labor for Palestine and Jews for Palestinian Right of Return. He also has participated in attorney delegations to Palestine, Egypt, and in successful campaigns for Stevie Wonder to observe the BDS movement and the boycott of Israeli Zimline ships more recently. I should have mentioned Jamil will speak first after Michael's introduction and discuss the issue of displacement and return in Israel today. And Michael will round out the panel by talking about how activists are responding to the marginalization of the right of return and also how the right in return fits into larger human rights advocacy. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Michael to give a brief introduction to the Palestinian refugee question, and then we'll begin with our speakers.
It's an honor to be here with distinguished fellow panelists, and particularly I want to thank the organizers of this event, Aman, Omar, and NYU Students for Justice in Palestine, especially for having braved the witch hunt type atmosphere that seeks to silence supporters of Palestinian rights so much today that I know you mentioned or was mentioned earlier at NYU, but is much broader than that. And I just want to start by saying that, you know, in 1964, there was a free speech movement throughout the University of California to advocate civil rights for black people, which was shut down by the university. That the advocacy was until this mass movement, the free speech movement, developed. And today, 52 years later, there really is a new free speech movement, and that free speech movement is to advocate the rights of Palestinians. And this explains, I think, the solidarity in recent times between black freedom activists, actually going all the way back to the 1960s, with Palestinians, and which has been reclaimed today in the form of groups like Black for Palestine, which arose from Ferguson and the Black Lives Matter movement. And as been mentioned earlier, the heart of the Palestinian struggle for freedom is refugees' right of return, as reflected in UN Resolution 194, which I know will be mentioned and discussed in more detail by the other panelists, as well as in the three demands of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS, movement, that calls for not only an end to the occupation of Palestinian land and full equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, but above all for the right of return of refugees throughout historic Palestine. And I think the purpose of this conference and this discussion is to explain why that is and how, or at least to shed some light on it. And by way of getting at why, it seems to me we have to start with what. And the what are 7 million, the number of Palestinian refugees today, who constitute 70% of the entire Palestinian people, many in refugee camps in the West Bank, Gaza, Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria. Interestingly, the majority of these refugees still live within 60 miles of their historic homeland. Indeed, 80% of the 1.8 million people in Gaza, what has been called the world's largest open-air prison, are refugees from 1948 Palestine, what Palestinians and many others call what the Israeli state claims to be. And that includes, by the way, the village of Sderot, where supposedly the Israelis are constantly being bombarded by Palestinian missiles, supposedly. Interestingly, that's a village a place that was founded in 1951 on lands that belonged to the Palestinian Arab village of Najd, which was destroyed by the Israeli state. Which brings us into how and why. In a word, Zionism, the establishment of a Jewish state and the artificial creation and maintenance of a Jewish majority in 1948 Palestine through the forced removal of the indigenous Palestinian people. That's why there are 7 million Palestinian refugees. Think Indian removal and manifest destiny in the United States, and you'll have a pretty good idea of what that has meant in Palestine. In 1948, this Jewish state was established through the Nakba, or catastrophe, which consisted of erasure and occupation of more than 500 Palestinian towns and villages, dispossession of over 750,000 Palestinians, in a terror campaign of which the massacre at Deir Yassin is emblematic. Since 1967, Israel has occupied and colonized the remainder of historic Palestine. And today, this, as you will hear from the other panelists, this relentless ethnic cleansing continues, armed and financed by the United States, our own government, and its allies. And this has created a diaspora of Palestinian refugees that is reflected in this well-known map, Palestinian land loss, that shows how settler colonialism in Palestine has reduced Palestinian land ownership. And you, there are maps very similar to this in regard to Native American land loss in this country. And the same could be said of other settler colonial societies. Because this Jewish state cannot exist without this ongoing ethnic cleansing, Zionists insist on the surrender of Palestinian right of return. Conversely, those who uphold human rights believe that refugees' right of return is essential, fundamental, and non-negotiable. As BDS founder Omar Barghouti puts it, quote, "The right of return is a basic right that cannot be given away. It's inalienable." That's why I work with Al Ouda in New York, the Palestine Right of Return Coalition. That's why I'm here today for Jews for Palestinian Right of Return. And with that, I will turn it over to my fellow panelists.
Let me start with thanking the organizers and the law school's Student for Justice in Palestine for bringing this important event. And I agree, we often hear more about the noise is more about a suppression of speech and denying those kinds of conversations to take place than actually dealing with the substance of what is the right of return, what is the issue of occupation, what is the right to equality for Palestinian citizens, etc. So this is a really important opportunity. I'm glad to be here. I should also start by saying that I'm speaking not on behalf of the ACLU. The ACLU as a U.S. organization does not take positions on foreign policy matters, particularly on violations of human rights in other countries, notwithstanding the important role that the United States plays in supporting the State of Israel. But I'm speaking here more in my personal capacity, based on my experience and work as a staff attorney of Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel, as well as my many years of activism, legal activism and otherwise. So let me focus on a particular area that the organizers asked me to focus on today, which is the internally displaced Palestinians who became internal refugees within their own homeland, and specifically speaking or focusing on Palestinian citizens of Israel. Internal displacement within the history of Palestinian is an ongoing, unfortunate, ongoing experience. There's almost not a day that passes without some Palestinian, some form of forced displacement happens in historic Palestine, whether it happens in the Naqab, in the south of Israel, whether it's happening in the West Bank, whether it's happening in other parts of historic Palestine. So this is an issue that has not ceased to take place, and we need to recognize that. But I would want to really share with you the experience of Palestinian citizens of Israel, because it's always neglected angle or neglected part of the Palestinian history and experience. Despite the fact that the Palestinians became citizens of Israel in 1948, and at the time there were about 18-19% of Israel's population, and continue to be about the same size, 19-20% of Israel's population. And and their existence as citizens did not immunize them, did not give them immunity from being displaced, being denied access to their historical lands, being denied to return to their own homes and lands that they had left or forced to leave during the 1948 war. And that experience is one that requires us to look at the political, legal, and diplomatic effort that went into sustaining by the State of Israel in from the very beginning of the state, in the very first years, starting with declaring a state of emergency, which, by the way, continues to exist until this day in Israel. So this, the state of Israel as a whole, not I'm not talking about the West Bank or Gaza, I'm talking about Israel proper, continues to this day to be under a state of emergency. Two, the second part was to use both a combination of force, other ways of, during the time of war, spread rumors of massacre going to happen, using all kinds of tactics that are really considered to be terror tactics under the Geneva Conventions that terrorize civilian populations in a time of war, in order to make sure that Palestinians, as many Palestinians, leave their land and their property and their houses and cities and towns, and make sure that at the time the Zionist militias and Zionist groups would take over those areas. And we don't have the time to go through the details of what happened during the war, because there's a lot of historians now have well documented, including Israeli historians, by the way, known as the new historians, that clearly show, in particular, I want to mention Ilan Pappe as the one who consistently documented the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And as part of that process, there had to be also a way of legal regime in order to make sure that those Palestinian refugees who, for different reasons, left their homes and lands, were again forced, left, as it happens in every war, and I don't think that anyone would think that you would stay in your place put despite the fact that you would be under the threat of being killed, being injured or massacred, to make sure that those individuals would not make it back, or at the very least would not be able to establish the same kind of relationship, whether it's a legal property rights or access of rights of freedom of movement, and able to establish some sort of precedent for the Palestinians to claim their land and property back. So the idea was, from the very beginning, as was mentioned earlier, seeing the right of return as an existential threat for the state of Israel. And that meant that that existential threat means not necessarily that by the return of Palestinian refugees, all of a sudden those refugees will be holding arms and will be killing Jews, but rather existential threat in changing the landscape of the state of Israel into one where there are people who would have to share the land on equal basis, where the privileges and the extra rights that were given under the State of Israel laws, starting with the law of a law of return and many other laws, would not break that kind of system of first-class citizenship for Israeli Jews and a second-class citizenship that has been afforded to Palestinian citizens. And particularly I want to mention the following. The fact that as many as 85% of the Palestinians, citizens of Israel, who remained within the state of Israel shortly after 1948, were living in areas that were declared as military areas. And these areas were three major areas, one in the north that covered major parts of the Galilee, one in the center, which covered major parts of the Triangle area, and one in the south, which covered big parts of the Negev, of the Naqab. And for that, that meant also to use additional laws under the state of emergency situation in order to make sure that some areas will be declared closed military areas, some property would be confiscated under different rationales. One, for example, would be based under the absentee property law, which the Israeli Knesset passed in 1950. It replaced a temporary emergency law that was in place between 1948 to 1950. And basically, it allowed the Israeli authorities to confiscate the land, or to take custody over the land and to hand it over to the custodian of absentees. And that land was not transferred to the state yet until the Israeli Knesset had to pass another law in order to do that. Another form of prevention of Palestinian citizens who were part of the community of Palestinian communities who were pushed out and forced out of their communities. One other way was to declare some of those the areas closed military areas, similar to what we hear now happening in the West Bank. And as such, that kind of technique or that kind of method allowed the state to say, well, you as a Palestinian, even though you are a citizen, you can access this particular land. And if you had to access that, actually you had to get a permit because there was a permit system that was established under the military regime that existed between 1948 and 66. And because you are not, and later on, because the land was not used, cultivated, the Israeli authorities found the legal pretext to confiscate the land because the land was not used and cultivated, or for other national security reasons, whether the land was close to the border. What is important to remember in this struggle is that the internally displaced Palestinians that in 2000 numbered about 250,000, now they're about roughly 450,000 or so, and they live in different parts of the country, continue to have attachment and deep connections to their ruined and destroyed villages and communities. Although they had to relocate and live in those Palestinian villages that survived the 1948 war, and you're talking about in 1948, you're talking about over 400 Palestinian villages and towns that were completely destroyed. And so some of the residents who were fortunate and lucky enough to be able to relocate and stay or even come back from neighboring Arab countries during the years between 1948 and the mid-50s were left with the option of living in current Palestinian towns and villages, like Nazareth, that absorbed a big number of internally displaced Palestinians. It's important also to mention that the Palestinians never said that we don't want to go back. They always wanted to exercise, and in fact, every year, Palestinians commemorate the Nakba by going to their ancestor lands, by going to their villages. Usually there's a national rally in one of those destroyed villages. And there's a lot of organizing going on, particularly under the umbrella of the National Committee on the Defense of the Rights of Internally Displaced Persons, or Palestinians, that started its activism in the mid-90s, following the Oslo Accords that completely ignored or completely sidelined the rights of Palestinian refugees, and in particular the rights of Palestinian internally displaced. So with that in mind, I wanted to, I don't know how much time we have left. I wanted to give you another example of a case study of how does actually that happen in fact for the Palestinian internally displaced. I want to give you an example of a village that that is very close to the Lebanese-Israeli border now in the north of Palestine, called Ikrit. Ikrit is a Palestinian Christian village. Many people think that, you know, Palestinian people is only about one ethnic or religious group. Rather, it is actually very diverse. And one of the many Palestinian refugees were actually also coming from Palestinian, predominantly Palestinian Christian communities or villages. But the history of it is that if you go back to the history that was now more documented by historians, they show that Israeli authorities and Israeli Zionist groups and the government, as it started in after its declaration in 1948, tried to avoid harming and forcing out Palestinian Christian communities because of the threat of a backlash in the international public opinion, particularly upsetting, you know, the Western countries, upsetting the Church, the Catholic, the Vatican, etc. And that has some maybe that may explain the reason why. There were more Palestinian, relatively speaking, more Palestinian Christian communities who were able to survive the war and to stay and remain in their country. Now, that doesn't mean that there were no displacements and denial of the right to return for Palestinian Christians. As all Palestinian communities, regardless of religion, they were subject to the same plan of making sure that we would liberate those territories, take control, military control over their territories, and make sure that we maintain as fewer number of Palestinians as possible. Because the idea of the Zionist project was to realize the Zionist project in the creation of a state of Israel that predominantly is a Jewish, or maintains a Jewish majority, is a Jewish state for the Jewish people. And the existence of non-Jews, and in fact you would hardly hear or see in the history of the records of the state of Israel reference to the words Palestinians. They would be either called non-Jews, they would be either called referred by their own religions, because Israel, after all, is a sectarian state, or they would be called, you know, all kinds of terminologies now used, Israeli Arabs, Arabs Israelis, and stuff like that, just to negate or to diminish the Palestinian identity of this community. And that plan included orders that were given to commanders and military commanders to do that. So those communities that were able to take refuge in nearby villages, my grandfather, who was participating in the hostilities as part of the local committees in the north, was in the fight, in the battlefield. My grandmother took her two sons and took refuge in an Arab Druze village near their town. And they were able to come back after the war was over, but my grandfather was still in detained as a prisoner of war in some camps that were actually where forced labor was done. And this is now documented, something that has been recently revealed as part of the International Committee of the Red Cross opening their archives in Geneva. And the case of Ikret is one that is interesting, because you see where even when the internally displaced Palestinians had a promise by the military commander to leave their village, to go and stay in a nearby village, in the village of Arami, while the hostilities end, while the war is until the war is over, yet they were not able to get back to their own country, and despite the fact that they were citizens. So for that matter, citizenship really did not give them an extra right other than the ability to remain and to, despite all the challenges and restrictions, even to file legal challenges to the Israel Supreme Court. And in fact, the communities of Ikret filed a petition, one of the early petitions to be filed on behalf of internally displaced, as did other communities, Al-Ghabsiyi and others. But Ikret's did particularly is important for legal scholars and lawyers, because the Supreme Court in the early days of the early 1950s actually did say that they have a certain right of return, and that they had a promise, and that promise should be fulfilled, while at the same time the Israeli government took the decision to destroy their village. And they declared the village entirely a closed military area, claiming that there was a national security reason for doing so, because it's very close to the Lebanese border. There were all kinds of infiltrators, Palestinian infiltrators, those inhabitants, native indigenous Palestinians, who were refugees trying to come back to their homeland, were forced by force stopped from coming in, coming back. And as a result, they were continued to struggle for return. Their struggle obviously took a different nature because they are citizens. And then during the 1990s, there was another attempt, I'm going to skip that part, but there was another attempt to go to the court during the Begin government, and they had been told that for national security reasons, we defer to the government for their displacement, and they will not be able to go back. But hopefully, if things get better, they should return to their village. Subsequently, after the beginning of the Oslo Accords, the community continued to struggle for the return. And they said, while at the same time, a lot of the land was already taken and used by Jewish communities in that area. And the only two landmarks that remained in Ikrit, if you go, you can actually go and visit them today, is the cemetery and the church, and where people continue to bury their loved ones in that cemetery and go to the church wherever they are. You know, they marry people there. They have they go to the different sermons. But the point is, they were not able to go back, and only after advocacy, specific advocacy, because of the fact that the Supreme Court in the early years determined that they actually have the right to go back to their land, the government was able to establish a ministerial committee that recommended to come to a plan where it will accommodate and will provide some sort of a plan for them to go back, but it will not include all of the land that was part of the village. It would be very limited to a particular area. They would create a communal village on a much very short or very small area, but they will at the same time will, and there will be some sort of a compensation given to others. Ultimately, this plan did not move forward, and it was rejected in terms of some people in the community rejected that as a way of negating the right to of return and full compensation and taking back their own lands, but also because of the political situation has changed in a way that allowed the government to say, no, that is actually not a good idea for us, even for such a small community of hundreds of people that are attached to the village of Ikrit. And the reason was, this is going to set a precedent for Palestinian right of return. And in fact, the last attempt of the village of Ikrit to get another chance before the Israel Supreme Court, Ariel Sharon's government at the time submitted a statement, a declaration, that said the government opposes their return because it fears to create this precedent. And their case has been dismissed, and to this day, they're going back to the organizing, to the ideal of returning, despite the fact that their laws or the courts have not been able to provide them with any remedy. So this is one example that represents the best scenario for, or best case for, Palestinian internally displaced, where they were not given any remedy, were not given any the recognition and the exercise of the right of return. And now Palestinians as a whole, internally displaced, continue to organize and think about ways of achieving, realizing their right as part of a Palestinian vision toward the future. 10 years ago, and I will close with that, 10 years ago there were a number of important documents that were adopted by the Palestinian civil society, political leadership in Israel. They were called the vision documents. And those documents speak about the historic injustice that happened to the Palestinian people, but specifically focus on Palestinian rights within Israel. And they specifically address land and housing planning policies and the injustice that happened to Palestinians with regard to confiscation of their land, particularly to internally displaced Palestinians. And in those documents, there is a demand on Israel not only to recognize them, to recognize the injustice, pay reparations, end structural racism, and end all these laws that confiscated land, but there's a specific demand for the State of Israel to look at the historic injustice that was done to the internally displaced Palestinians and to deal with this issue as part of the reconciliation, as part of making Israel a democratic state that is truly committed to equal citizenship, while recognizing the right of all people in that country. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamil. I want to hand it over next to Emilio.
Thank you. Thank you so much to the organizers for considering me for this event. In my work in Palestine at the International Law and Human Rights Program in East Jerusalem, I have been insistently trying to advance a more critical scholarship on internal Palestinian law, PA's law. Basically, this has been totally ignored. But I said that I have been trying to advance some more critical scholarship on Palestinian PA's law, because for a strange reason, some of them understandable, these PA laws have been somehow ignored by critical scholarship, and many times I have found myself trying to justify why I'm working on a PA's legislative production. Many people say, what is the importance? We are under occupation, we don't have an state, so what is the importance of PA laws? Why are you studying that? I think you are losing your time. Some people ask me, in what sense has Palestinian PA legal production changed, even slightly, the real life of Palestinian people? And I would like to try to respond to this question. How or has effectively Palestinian PA laws changed anything on the ground? To this question, I would like simply to reply, at the risk of raising eyebrows, that PA's legal regime, though it did not deliver its promises, and that I can agree, has participated in the transformation of almost every aspect of our lives that Oslo brought about in occupied Palestine and beyond. Oslo, the inception of the PA and its legal structures, carried with them a new cognitive grid for social meaning and political action, and that strongly impacted on refugees' fate. These transformations are of material, symbolic, and discursive nature. They advance categories of perception, violently departing from those before Oslo. And their pervasive impact explain that Palestinian contemporary politics is not fully understandable within the pre-Oslo categories of social and political meaning. Indeed, how to explain otherwise that demonstrations, for example, in Ramallah to support Palestinian prisoners in hunger strike would gather only a handful of supporters, while people continue shopping and very often seem to have only disdain for the demonstrators. How to explain, how else to explain that today Fatah, for example, can see Israel as a potential ally in their fight against Hamas? How can we understand that Palestinian security services repress and torture Palestinians to protect Israel, share intelligence, and assist Israeli security services in their own repression of Palestinians? How to explain that Abbas and other public officers can publicly insist and defend the sacred nature of security coordination with Israelis without being unanimously labeled as traitors and punished in the way that they were before Oslo? How to make sense of the fact that prominent members of the Palestinian bourgeoisie in occupied Palestine can host and offer dinners in their own houses to Israeli military officials on the 15th of May to celebrate Israeli independence? How to understand all the ways in which Palestinian elites today normalize relations with Israel in the field of businesses, academia, and politics? All this does not only remind us of Fanon's idea that anti-colonialist struggle is not automatically written from a nationalist perspective, but it also forces us to revisit all these pre-Oslo ideas that we take for granted. without trying to romanticize the history of the Palestinian national movement, the fact is that some old categories of perception in the Palestinian society, which were generally structured around some common experiences, statuses, practices, and objectives, for example, the territorialized national movement as scattered people with the same national objectives and a shared sense of identity, subjected to exile or occupation and fighting a common enemy, all these have been patently changed or have been redefined. And my point is that severely impacting on the fate of refugees. And my point is that PA laws have contributed to these transformations. Living in Ramallah for the last 8 years and researching on law, I have been directly exposed to the fact that the PA's institutions and legal production are not just the silent and passive products of social and political forces, but they also have a performative ability to produce social reality. First, these legal structures facilitated and consolidated the emergence of new social groups, divisions, hierarchies, etc. Second, the PA's legal regime has advanced new forms and sources of authority, legitimacy, social status, subjectivity, identities, and categories of social meaning that reinforce these changes. Third, legal and institutional processes promoted particular discursive practice and strategies that, while emphasizing the concept of peace process, institutional building, statehood, economic development, and the language of rights and law at the expenses of the real end to colonial rule, seemed to progressively reorganize social and political action in and around Palestine. In the symbolic realm, the PA legal structures have not only served to institutionalize, legitimize, and consolidate specific avenues for political and social action that guarantee and reinforce the reproduction of its social order, but they have also contributed to the redefinition of identities. As Combi emphasizes, since identity is not only a matter of the roles of individuals or their own identification, but also of the categorization of individuals or groups by the state, institutions and other groups, identity may also be delineated from the outside. The redefinition of identities produced by Oslo legal structures included the very concept of who is a Palestinian and directly impacted on refugees. Indeed, before Oslo, the prevailing notion of Palestinian was defined by the PLO Charter as those Arab citizens who were normally living in Palestine up to 1947, and every child who was born to a Palestinian father after this date, whether in Palestine and outside. This was a Palestinian. Anyone normally living in Palestine until 1947 and their descendants. Even though this definition has not technically changed, Oslo's frame and laws symbolically, but also practically, has reduced this notion of Palestinians to the inhabitants of the West Bank and Gaza, progressively excluding Palestinians in Israel, refugees and diaspora from the political process. Indeed, this can be metaphorically illustrated by the fact that Article 34 of the amended Basic Law of 2003, the current constitutional text, even if suspended, states that the president, the Palestinian constitution says that the president is elected in a general and direct election by the Palestinian people. Article 97 prescribes that the ruling of the court shall be announced and executed in the name of the Palestinian Arab people. Moreover, the preamble of the draft Basic Law from the very first reading stated that the power and legitimacy of the Basic Law arises from the will of the Palestinian people. In all these cases, the constitutional text is silent on the fact that the only Palestinians who are part of the PA's political and legal processes
are the inhabitants of the West Bank and Gaza, whereby excluding the majority of Palestinians living outside the occupied territories, refugees, and diaspora. The electoral law of 95, for example, clarified and strengthened this point by defining an elector as every Palestinian inhabitant of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including Jerusalem. Furthermore, and even though more than 50% of the Palestinian people live outside the Palestinian territory and are forbidden from entering, to be eligible for president or to be elected to the parliament, the electoral law requires voters to have a fixed residential address inside the Palestinian territory. Further exclusion of large parts of the Palestinian people, as understood in the PLO Charter, from the PA's legal and discursive imaginary has been objectified in law. For example, Article 7 of the same electoral law, after establishing the cases in which someone qualifies as a Palestinian for the purposes of voting or running for elections, sets a general condition, which is that the person has not acquired Israeli citizenship, excluding ipso facto Palestinians in Israel. In turn, the law of NGOs of 1999 forbids the participation of Palestinians from Israel in the administration of these institutions. Thus, Palestinians inside Israel maintain a complex relation with the authority characterized by their blurred position in the PA's imaginary and their lack of institutional links with it. Moreover, the status of Palestinians inside Israel was not even discussed in Oslo, neither during the drafting of the Basic Law nor during the drafting of the definitive Palestinian constitution for the state. Even though the identification of the Palestinians inside Israel with the Palestinian cause is not in doubt, there are virtually no trans-border Israel-Palestinian territory structures of Palestinian political mobilization. In this context, the Palestinian organizations inside Israel increasingly orient their work to the defense of their interests as a minority inside Israel, and in these efforts, their interlocutor is primarily the Israeli state. It plays perfectly into the Israeli strategy of disassociating this population from the Palestinian national struggle. Regarding refugees outside Palestine in other countries, it is worth noting that in 96 and 2006 Palestinian elections, no efforts were made to materialize the participation of refugees and diaspora Palestinians. In contrast to the elections in other countries with similar conditions of occupation such as Iraq and Afghanistan. Not really surprising, given that as early as 1994, Nabil Shaath, ex-foreign minister, stated that, and quote, Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, that was in 94, that Palestinian refugees in Lebanon were not the PA's responsibility, but UNRWA's. In 94 also, Ziad Abu Ziad, PLC member, the PA's parliament, PLC member and PA minister, distinguished between the principle of the right of return and its actual applicability of return to the homeland and to that same home, piece of land, which a certain Palestinian owned before 1948. According to Abu Ziyad, Palestinians should enjoy the principle of the right of return, but its more realistic application would be to attract them to a future Palestinian state. In 2010, Abu Mazen himself declared before a Jewish North American audience, quote, I would never deny the Jewish right to the land of Israel, overlooking the fact that the Jewish right to the land has been based on the denial of the right of return for Palestinian refugees. Indeed, from the beginning of the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations in Madrid and later in Oslo, Israel imposed as a condition the exclusion of refugees from the discussions. In the agreements themselves, this solution was accepted and the refugee issue was left for final status talks. Moreover, the Oslo agreements simply excluded any reference to the UN General Assembly Resolution 194, to the UN Charter, or international law at all. Later, Arafat himself suggested the idea that the right of return may be renounced for some categories of refugees, and a solution to the refugees within an agreement acceptable to Israel, which meant subjecting Resolution 194 to various interpretations. This evolution in refugee status has brought about an increasing uncertainty regarding who is a Palestinian within the PA institutional frame and in whose name PA officials speak. Refugees have found their rights gradually excluded from the PA's political claims and see with suspicion an authority which is likely willing to give up their rights in order to obtain political results in their bargaining with Israel. I want to conclude by saying that from the PA standpoint, incorporating refugees in the political process has become dangerous in that it may put at stake its own political and institutional power. In this context, one cannot expect but an increasing exclusion of the refugees from the PA's imaginary and political agenda. Thank you.
And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
You are listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you.
I do not posit that there has been a secret conspiracy to take over the government. I think there are processes. Nobody really controls it. People at certain moments made some key decisions. I think they were always ad hoc things, not like this is step one in establishing the deep state. It was just, no, the president has to go. These are processes. The instruments are there, the machinery is there, the personnel keep changing. But once these processes are in motion, then they acquire their own logic. For example, if the governing media of this country commit themselves to the position that the president was killed by a lone nut, then they're committed to lying for eternity, really. For them to tell the truth about the Kennedy assassination would mean to have to say we participated in a lie for the public good, but nonetheless a lie.
You're listening to episode 719 of Unwelcome Guests, The Processes and Logic of the Deep State. I'm Robin Upton, and I assembled that short set of quotes from today's speaker, Professor Peter Dale Scott, because I don't want you to get lost in details. If you can take them on board, then great. But we've had a lot of new listeners to the show, so I thought let's give an overview over what this entity, the US Deep State, actually is. Now, who better to do that than Professor Peter Dale Scott, who coined the phrase the deep state and deep politics. As he highlights, we don't need to think of a parallel government as being a mirror of the publicly available government with responsibilities and duties. No, it's much more like, say, mafia bosses in a loose alliance, sometimes rivalry, with one credo to which they all adhere, that their doings must remain secret. I think that's a fatal flaw in this age of burgeoning communications technology. So quite apart from the other self-destructive logics, that would be enough to bring this system down. Many thanks to Dark Journalist, who recorded the following excellent interview. The audio quality itself is not up to the standard of the interviewing, so that's disappointing. If that's a real problem for you, then please let me know via feedback. I just got used to it and managed to make good sense of what Peter Dale Scott was saying. This was carried out in January 2015.
Now, I thought we'd start our discussion today by having you define what the deep state is, what does it encompass, and how would an average person understand its role in our daily lives?
Okay, well, we can begin by saying that there is a gap in attention between the institutions that are defined by the Constitution, are responsible to the Constitution on one level, and then the second level, institutions like the CIA and the NSA, which operate in secret. There's something about secret power that is, it's not controllable, and it's very important that the CIA's budget has never been exclusively a budget voted by Congress. So it's a level of the deep state higher than the public state. And then I want to go to a third level, but we skip to the fourth level, which are ultimately, Roosevelt himself said to a friend back in 1933, you and I know that a financial element has been controlling this country since the age of Jackson. That's the ultimate level, I think, is extreme wealth and the institutions that deal with extreme wealth. But in between, there's a third public level, CIA level, and then companies like Booz Allen Hamilton that interface with the CIA, recruit from the CIA, and are recruited by the CIA. And then they also work with corporations all over the world and with banks all over the world. And the same thing happens. There's an interaction of a revolving door, both between these corporations and the CIA, and also between these corporations and the highest level of banks and major oil companies and so on.
Okay.
And so the ensemble is a level, you have a levels of government, some of which are written about in the media, and some of which are not written about in the media. You very rarely see Booz Allen Hamilton in the headlines, but if you write what I would call a deep history of, say, American relations with Egypt, the CIA is going to be in that history, and the Booz Allen Hamilton are going to be in that history.
Right. So ordinarily, we're looking at the public side of our society, elective government, law and order, justice, daily news reporting, and that kind of thing. But underneath, there are these deep state forces that are operating in contracting for intelligence agencies, in corporate, financial, and political circles. And they are having an impact with very little transparency.
Right. So there's a lot of things in the deep state that I talk about in this woolly way, because we think of history as taught in universities is archival history, working with documents, and that gives us, I mean, that's a good method, and we get good history, but we get limited history because a lot of what's going on in the deep state is undocumented.
Right.
And when people like me try to write deep history, we have to resort to all kinds of techniques to fill the vacuum that, because we don't have, as a rule, every now and then we're lucky and we get a document here.
Yes, well, there have been some breakthroughs, I would say, with Freedom of Information Act requests, even if they are few and far between. Now, can you think of a document that when it came out, it just made you stop and say, this is major?
A key one. We have the CIA document after the Kennedy assassination instructing the media on how to handle it. And they use the phrase conspiracy theory. As far as I know, that's the first time that we have a document that talks about conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
It's CIA telling the newspapers how to attack people like me.
Right. And the basic instructions from the CIA to their media assets was call them conspiracy theorists, and that will have the effect of marginalizing them and take some of the heat off.
Right, exactly. Well, we don't get many of those documents. We get a few. But we have to look around the known world that we see and we read about in the newspapers. And I think actually most Americans have some awareness of this. You know, if they live in a city like Chicago.
Sure.
Maybe not now, but 50 years ago, the mob was in City Hall. And anybody who had anything to do with City Hall knew that because they had to pay certain people off and so on.
Right.
It's not in the official history of Chicago.
Well, this is interesting because you've done some real investigation on how organized crime is a component of the deep state and has these connections that we don't hear very much about.
That's where I really began with this kind of analysis because I wrote a book called Deep Politics and the Death of JFK.
That's an excellent book.
The biggest gap in the Warren Report is when they were saying that Ruby was a loner, when Ruby was obviously somebody very clued in with the mob, and that's half of it, also very clued in with Dallas high society, and above all, clued in with the Dallas police. And we actually have testimony from Dallas police officers saying they used Jack Ruby as an informant on the drug traffic. And we have somebody else who told the FBI that a big drug deal only went through in Dallas after Jack Ruby gave the okay on it.
Uh-huh.
Now, the Warren Commission received these documents, and then they said he was a loner. Well, that taught me that you have to see more to politics than what's on the record.
Yeah.
And organized crime was where I went in. That led me to the drug traffic. It led me to the CIA. And
yes, and you found that interface between the CIA and organized crime.
Yeah.
In your book, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, you outline all of these intelligence connections that Oswald had and how through these connections he was set up to appear in a certain way as a kind of leftist loner, and that this method was actually used in 9/11 also, but there it was applied to 19 people instead of just one.
Yes, I think that I have more than one book where I draw attention to the analogies between Kennedy assassination and 9/11. And this is one of them, that what I call the designated culprits.
Yeah, that's a great term.
Who were already known to the agencies, in the CIA in particular, and in both cases, the CIA was covering up, both on Oswald and on the alleged hijackers, to make sure that they would not be rounded up before the deep events that they are attached to, because then they couldn't have been the designated culprits.
I see. So on a certain level, they're being protected right up to the point where they can be used in a scapegoat role.
Right. And that's a matter of history now with Oswald,
uh-huh.
But it should be a matter of grave concern, and actually is right now. People campaigning to get those 28 pages from the Joint Congressional Investigation of 9/11.
Yeah.
At least we pretty well know a good deal of the story by now anyway, but it would be an official documentation of the Saudi money going to these alleged hijackers, the CIA's protection of these hijackers, the lying, saying that they had given money to the information to the FBI when in fact they had refused to give, as they should have given the information to the FBI. All of that would come out. That would be one way, I think, of ending the state of emergency we're in, to see the really corrupt way in which it was instituted in 9/11 in the first place.
Right. So you could almost say that Oswald and the hijackers share this kind of archetype of how to portray someone as an off-balance fanatic, but with no outside connections to any state sponsors or intelligence organizations.
Yeah.
One of the things that you've said in relation to the state of emergency that we're still in is that we've actually been under it for 13 years already, but a lot of people don't seem to know that. Or that NORTHCOM has, since 2008, an army division based here in America that's set up to deal with public unrest. So these are two things you don't hear a whole lot about, but are critical in your view.
Yes. I mean, I think the, you know, one of the difficult periods of American history was the Reconstruction era, when the South was, in effect, subjugated and occupied by an army. And the Reconstruction ended with a disputed election in which a president was elected by a deal to end the occupation, which they did. And so we had a century of Jim Crow, thankfully more somewhat over now, not complete. But we also had the Comitatus Acts, which became part of the effective American style of government, that you do not use the military in a permanent way for law enforcement and homeland security.
Yes.
And we all upended that. The division has been there since 2008, but NORTHCOM has been there since 2002. Was part of the, and it had been planned for by COG. Three things had been planned for: warrantless surveillance. We know about that now. Warrantless detention, and most people are not aware of that. I just yesterday I found a very knowledgeable man not aware that something like 1,000 Muslims, maybe more, were rounded up after 9/11 without a warrant, without charges, held, interrogated. In the case of one man that I talked, who was badly beaten until there was blood in his urine.
Wow.
And this is, you know, reminds me of the Jews in Germany and also being persecuted and punished, and people afterwards said, oh, I didn't know. Americans would say, honestly, they didn't know about these Muslims, but they should.
Yeah.
They should, because it is a blot that we have habeas corpus is mentioned in the Constitution, but it was just torn into shreds by COG planning. And so you have warrantless surveillance, warrantless detention, and the permanent militarization of Homeland Security. Originally, it was plans for martial law. That we don't quite have that, but we do have now a military component, not only to law enforcement and dealing with disturbances, but also surveillance. The military are involved in the surveillance of people like you and me.
Exactly.
And they shouldn't be.
Yeah. Now, on COG, this is something you've done some amazing research on and really brought to light. But there's a common misconception out there that COG was something that was around during the Cold War and then sort of went away in the 90s. But that's not the case, is it?
No.
And just to clarify, COG is continuity of government, in which the government would implement emergency planning in the event of an incredible emergency.
An atomic attack, originally.
Right, an atomic attack, and exactly.
The decapitation of the government. See, the Constitution says, oh, if you lose the president, then the vice president becomes the president. But supposing a bomb lands on Washington and you lose the president and the vice president and the Speaker of the House, this was very legitimate planning to deal with an atomic attack, because we were threatening atomic attacks from time to time, and so was Russia. But what happened in the right after the Reagan Revolution in 1982, they started this was Casey and I think Vice President Bush and certainly Oliver North, who was the executive officer. They started conceiving of COG, continuity of government planning, to deal with domestic crises. North was very keen on rounding up Hispanics who were supporting the Sandinistas, but Hispanics in this country, citizens in this country. And they passed an executive order towards the end of Reagan's administration, but which said that COG planning was to deal with any emergency, not just an atomic emergency. And then in 1994, there was an unfortunate story in the New York Times by, I believe, Tim Weiner, that said that there was, it actually said that all of this COG planning had ceased. And it was true that they decided to not where after the fall of the Berlin Wall, they ceased planning for an atomic attack, but they did not at all cease planning for the implementation of COG. And in fact, they intensified it. And what was really disturbing here was that in 1994, we had a Democratic president, Clinton.
Right.
And according to a very good book by Andrew Coburn, Clinton didn't really know what was going on, but the planning continued. And this is, to me, very significant that two of the key planners have been in there ever since 1982 and were in there up until Bush was elected, or if that's the word, in 2000, were Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. They spent 20 years planning for the implementation of COG, and then on 9/11, while the president was out of the Capitol, those same two men implemented it. And because they had the power to do it, because the executive order said it was for any emergency, and they said 9/11 is an emergency. And they proclaimed, when the president got back, he proclaimed officially an emergency, and that's the emergency we're still under. And that's why there's a permanent army brigade stationed inside the United States to deal with any dissident rally that might get out of control. We're in a kind of, I don't want to say police state, because we used to have police running us, but no, now we have the military in charge of Homeland Security, and that's in contravention of the comitatus laws that we used to have. So it's a very significant change, and so my book hopes that we will do something about this. And the very first step, as far as I'm concerned, is to have a debate in Congress to end this state of emergency.
Very interesting. Now, a couple of points I want to pick up on there when you're talking about continuity of government planning going on behind the scenes. Now, Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney were, at times when they were making these plans, not even in government. They were private citizens in high-ranking corporate positions. Is that right?
Exactly. They were chairman of organizations the whole time. That was the status of Rumsfeld. In the 1980s, most of the 1980s, Cheney was a congressman from Wyoming.
Right.
Why a single congressman should be picked out to plan for – this is planning for suspension of the Constitution. This is very serious planning, never authorized by Congress. It was it was all done by executive order. And then in the 90s, under Clinton, Cheney was, of course, briefly Secretary of Defense with the first President Bush.
Yeah.
But then he was the CEO of Halliburton. Halliburton had a huge stake in what was going on because they were heavily involved in the development of U.S. oil investments in Kazakhstan and Central Asia. And one of the chief consequences of 9/11 has been putting U.S. troops into Afghanistan and then Iraq, which was of major importance for the oil companies in Kazakhstan. They wanted to have U.S. troops around to make sure that the president of Kazakhstan would listen to the United States and not just to Russia, which also had troops in the area.
Uh-huh.
So Halliburton was not disinterested in this, but you had two CEOs of private U.S. corporations planning for the U.S. suspension of the U.S. Constitution, and it was done, according to Andrew Coburn, in the 90s, it was different from the 80s. 1980s, it had Democrats and Republicans, but the group in the Pentagon who were planning specifically on military responses in the 1990s were, according to Coburn, nearly all Republicans who despised Clinton. So it was like a government in waiting.
Yeah.
For the what we got in the year 2000, thanks to the Supreme Court.
Right. And one of the main players, if we want to predate the 90s and take a look at the 80s, was Oliver North, who, of course, was a key figure in the Iran-Contra scandal.
Right.
Now, what can you tell us about North and some of his positioning in relation to COG? You mentioned one intriguing thing in the book that he was very involved in called Rex 84. Can you tell us about that?
Right. I should have said that from the very beginning, FEMA was created under Carter. I think that their role was political from the beginning. I don't want to get into the Carter era, but in the Reagan era, they were the support group for COG planning. The executive officer for the COG planning was North, who, of course, was also the operations man on the Iran. Now, one of the biggest budget items of COG planning was to set up an alternative communications network, which was independent of the basic government communications network. This is sometimes called the Doomsday Network. That's the Pentagon's own term for it.
Yeah.
Just as the seat of government, if there had been an atomic plan, would have been what they call the Doomsday Plane. I have the cover of my book, which I hope you can see.
Oh, yeah.
That Doomsday Plane over the White House, because that actually happened on 9/11, and nobody has ever been able to explain why a plane was there over the White House, which, of course, is prohibited airspace. No airplane ever is supposed to be there. Anyway, X-84 was an exercise. The EX in there is an exercise, but it was an exercise in rounding up Americans.
Uh-huh.
So that is a clear sign that we've changed the emphasis on continuity of government planning to kind of civilian control. And that's, of course, the feature of Oliver North's activities. But there's a close intimacy between the COG planning and the Iran-Contra affair.
Okay.
Because the certainly the early stages of sending arms to Iran was not authorized. And Oliver North had a solution to that. He used the emergency network that had been set up for COG for the practical job of getting arms sent through Portugal without the U.S. ambassador to Lisbon being aware of this.
Uh-huh.
So that it was the underpinning for what Oliver North was doing. And this is maybe getting a bit ahead of your questioning, but one of the things I say in my book is that the COG network, the Doomsday Network, figures in all of these major deep events. 9/11 itself, it was implemented on that day. That's why the president and the vice president all through that day didn't stay in town together. First of all, Cheney, who was in Washington, told Bush to stay away, and then when Bush came back, Bush went, by the way, to Offutt Air Force Base, which
right.
is the base for the Doomsday planes. And then when he came back, Cheney went away, and he went away for 90 days and lived inside a hollowed-out mountain, which was part of the planning for COG. And he took a huge staff with him, almost 100 people. And what they did is off the books.
I bet.
I think we can speculate with some certainty that that's where they refined the Patriot Act,
yep.
which emerged out of nowhere. And certainly something called Project Endgame, which was a massive program for building detention centers, which was a kind of implementation of what had been exercised in Rex 84 back 17 years before.
And who do you think they're planning to detain in these centers, according to the documents?
Well, I can say with more confidence about the 1984 period, they were very focused on Hispanics because they didn't want domestic protests to what Reagan was doing with the Sandinistas.
Okay.
And there was a group called CISPES, And it came under attack from a number of directions. The FBI, the CIA set up something they shouldn't have set up. But specifically, the detention centers would have been rounding up members of CISPAS. And if they were not nationals, then deporting them back to Central America. And that did actually happen. And it was really sending people off to a death sentence. If you took somebody from CISPAS in America, sent them back to El Salvador, you had a ruthless military dictatorship in El Salvador. And, you know, there was all kinds of killings going on. Then none were killed. Jesuits were killed. A bishop was murdered.
Right.
It was a very bloody time in Central America. And I regret to say that the things that Vice President Bush and William Casey, who was the head of the CIA at the time, and Oliver North in particular, the things they were doing were war crimes. And I don't know if we'll ever get some kind of accounting for that, but they were definitely war crimes.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Now, when you speak about deep events and how they were linked with this doomsday network, let's take a snapshot of all the major deep events that have happened, starting with the JFK assassination, bringing us up to the present. What would you say are the five most crucial deep events that have happened in American history?
Yes, well, when we come to the Kennedy assassination, what's that got to do with the Doomsday Network? The answer is, well, there are many. It's quite a complex answer, but I'll just single out one salient detail to stand for the rest.
Okay.
And that is that the Secret Service agent who came down from Washington to plan the parade route, which ended up going by the school book depository where Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly shot at the president.
Yeah.
That Secret Service agent, all his communications were on the White House Communications Agency network, which was a branch of the Doomsday Network.
Aha.
And if I could jump fast forward to the 9/11 before I fill in what's in between.
Sure.
That network, I'm sure, was used again on 9/11, and the 9/11 Commission, looking for key decisions that were made, like the implementation of COG, they reported that they could find no record of the phone calls.
Oh.
And in another book I wrote, The Road to 9/11, which I summarize in this book, I made an argument that Cheney, you know, spent right in the middle of all this crisis. He was not in the what we call the PEOC, or the Emergency Operations Center, underneath the White House. He was somewhere else at a telephone. That was, I'm quite convinced, a Doomsday Network telephone. And the 9/11 Commission report records that, yes, COG was implemented on that day. And then they have a footnote and say that, in which they say, they did not look into COG. Well, that's like saying they didn't look into the very heart of 9/11.
Exactly.
Because the really key decisions, I think, were made on the COG network. I don't think they were ever given access to that network. So they tried to cover that up by saying it's okay, we just didn't look into it. Well, they didn't look into it because they couldn't look into it because they didn't have the clearances. All right, now let's go back. After the Kennedy assassination and this man, Winston Lawson, who was this key Secret Service agent, by the way, not the only person. I have a whole article that's complicated.
Yeah.
We come to Watergate, and the key burglar, James McCord, was also part of a secret Air Force unit that was planning for rounding up. I could read you the description if you like. We know what his job was there. And again, he was part of the Doomsday Network.
That's interesting.
And John Dean, who is the man who caused so much trouble for Nixon inside the White House, says in his book, Worse Than Watergate, he mentions that he was in charge of COG planning when he was in the Pentagon before he went to the White House.
So wow.
He actually took part in the COG planning. So you have two key figures, John Dean and James McCord, both part of this Doomsday Network. The Doomsday Network, when we come to the prevention of the re-election of Carter, I really don't have very much to say there, but I will speculate. This is
okay.
I think I maybe.
And here you're speaking about the October surprise.
Yeah, arms went to Israel then, and many books say that the networks that were used to send arms to Israel in 1980 were the same networks that were used to send arms to Israel in 1985, 86. That brings us, in other words, to Iran-Contra.
Okay.
Absolutely no doubt that Oliver North was part of the Doomsday planning in 1985, 86. We have these documents like Rex 84. And there's absolutely no doubt that he used what it was called, I think, Flashboard at the time. That was his name for it. But he was using a network outside of the regular communications network to negotiate these arms deals. So I suspect, although I have no proof, that if the setup in 1985 was the setup in 1980, then the secret network would have been used then too, because there were so many deep state personnel involved in this negotiating of the arms deal. And you know, William Casey was not yet the director of Central Intelligence,
right?
But had intelligence connections, and he was definitely a key figure in 1980 in flying to Paris and negotiating with Iranians about getting arms to Iran in exchange for a commitment not to release the hostages that had been seized in the U.S. embassy. And this proved to be true. They were not to be released until Reagan was inaugurated.
Yep.
The day that Reagan was inaugurated is the day that Iran released the hostages. That's a kind of corroboration that this deal was made.
Fascinating. And we have Vice President Bush deeply involved in these operations.
He was North's boss. They had a structure. There were a lot of different initials for different committees and things. But over and over, it's Vice President Bush's responsibility and Oliver North is the executive officer.
It is interesting how Bush Sr. shows up over and over again in these deep events. And I guess we need to remember that he was the CIA director in 1976. And that's one thing that got my attention when you wrote that 1976 was a crucial year in deep state activity. And you tied it in with all these Saudi arms shipments. And in a previous book, I read you were going to skip the Ford era completely. But eventually you realize all of these important things happened there. And it was a critical period of time to cover.
Right. That really all happened in my thinking when I was writing The Road to 9/11, and I ended up devoting a whole chapter to what I call the critical period of change. A number of things happened there. First of all, Congress had started to look into what the CIA was doing, and elements in the CIA, and Vice President Bush, when he became the director, was a key figure in this, they essentially went offshore. You know, if Congress is going to look at us, well, then we'll have other people do things for us. That's the year in which something called the Safari Club was created.
Right. And can you give just a quick description of what the Safari Club was and who was in it?
The Safari Club is a coming together of the heads of intelligence. The America doesn't figure in the masthead of the Safari Club, but they're behind it pulling the strings. One key figure is Alexandre de Maranche, who was the head of STIC, which is the French intelligence network, and he becomes a key figure advising Reagan even before Reagan is inaugurated.
Huh.
He's part of the kitchen cabinet advising Reagan. And then after that is the head of SAVAK in Iran, And this is very significant because the U.S. ambassador to Iran at this time is Richard Helms, who formerly had been the head of the CIA.
Oh, yeah.
And then you get the head of Saudi intelligence and the head of Egyptian intelligence, and they start doing covert operations. And to give one key example, they get very involved in Angola. Why involved in Angola? Because Congress had passed the so-called Clark Amendment, I think in 1975, which prohibited the CIA from conducting any more operations in Angola. So they got around the problem by having other people do what the CIA had done, and they were in close contact.
I see.
This is where the deep state comes in. These were not formal connections between the CIA and the Safari Club. This was a network of old boys like Richard Helms. And, of course, George H.W. Bush, when he was head of CIA in 1976, was not a stranger to the agency, and he was not a stranger to the Middle East, because he had run this offshore drilling company, Zapata Petroleum,
which
had contracts in the Persian Gulf with Kuwait. And so he was very much at home in that part of the world. And they just bypassed the regular bureaucracies.
Well, it sounds like the covert players formed their own kind of shadow CIA with their own rules. But do we know how the regular CIA leadership was viewing their activities?
Stansfield Turner was nominally the head of the CIA under Carter, but he didn't really know what was going on. He got rid of some people. Theodore Shackley being the most famous one. And those people, instead of just going home to write a book, they got involved with the Safari Club and advised them. So, and that's one of the two big things about 1976. But the other one, perhaps even more important, this prevented a restructure of the Cold War. The CIA had been advising for some time. This is the intelligence side of the CIA, as opposed to the covert operations side of the CIA, and there's always been tension between those two sides.
Yes.
They were saying that the Soviet Union is not the enemy that it once was, and this was anathema to the people who wanted to keep the Cold War going.
Sure.
This resulted in the head of the CIA at that time, help me, Bush's predecessor.
Director Colby.
Yes, William Colby was fired because he was putting up these intelligence reports.
Right.
And George H.W. Bush, the father, was put in as head of CIA. And then he created something called Team B, which he brought in a bunch of these are the advanced neocons.
Yeah.
These are the predecessors of the people who created the project for the New American Century in 2000, which really called for all the things that were implemented after 9/11. Back in 76, they said, no, the CIA's been wrong all along. The Soviet Union is a major threat, and they're spending a lot of money. In fact, they were spending a lot of money, but it was defensive. America had been spending so much against them.
Yes.
And, you know, when the missile crisis, it proved that America was on top. And
right.
The Soviets were trying to get parity, and I think the previous team had admitted that. But this got expanded into, no, the Soviet Union wants to take over the universe, certainly take over the globe. And we're still debating this a bit among the Soviet historians, but I think the consensus now is pretty much that the Team B assessment was wildly off base and that the original CIA assessment was closer. But the effects of this were huge because Carter had been elected on a promise to reduce the defense budget. That would
exactly.
have been, you know, returning to normalcy paths. And not only did he not reduce it, because of all these ominous threats from Team B, he expanded it. He We talk about the Reagan increases in the defense budget. They became huge under Reagan, but they didn't begin under Reagan. They began under Carter. That, again, shows you how the president is not really the man who runs the country, and the processes that go on in the deep state, or in this case in the CIA, can determine his agenda in a way which he will not be happy with.
Yes.
It's another example where presidents don't set agendas. And I think that we've seen it with Obama recently.
Oh, yeah.
He made a Middle East speech back in 2009, which was very promising. But almost everything that's happened since then has worked against rather than in the spirit of his original speech.
So definitely.
That's when I say now the deep state is thoroughly ensconced in our government. And as I said, in American War Machine, there's a mindset in Washington, and the president doesn't choose the mindset. The mindset chooses the president.
Uh-huh.
The regime you're in under now, I think.
Well, that really rings true when you look at the state of things now. A couple of things that you have in the book about how the deep state basically hijacked the COG planning, and also FEMA, which is an agency that was originally set up to deal with natural disasters,
yes.
So like
mm-hmm.
floods and earthquakes, for example. So essentially, the deep state figured out if we take over these two government functions, we can implement these authoritarian-style policies through them. Now, is that a fair statement?
My problem is what you just said. You're in the ballpark.
Okay, good.
My problem is I do not posit that there has been a secret conspiracy to take over the government.
All right.
I think there are processes always going on. I was 4 years in the Canadian government, and I spent 6 months in Washington in 1987 trying to help Senator Kerry investigate Contras and drug trafficking.
And that is a very good investigative report that Kerry put together.
Yes.
Going back to it now, it seems pretty advanced.
Kerry not in power was much better than Kerry in power, and that's unfortunately often the case with politicians.
Yes, well, it seems like all that he wants to do now is go in and attack Syria, basically.
Right. What goes on in government, particularly American government, which is so huge, nobody really controls it. I do think that people at certain moments made some key decisions. I think, I can't prove this, but I think there was a high-level decision that who made it, I don't know, but that Kennedy had to go.
And yeah.
I think it was a high-level decision that Nixon had to go. And it was a high-level decision that Carter had to go. But there were always ad hoc things, not like this is step one in establishing the deep state. It was just, no, the president has to go. But once these processes are in motion, then they acquire their own logic. For example, if the governing media of this country commit themselves to the position that the president was killed by a lone nut with no connections to anything, even though he had extensive CIA files and FBI files.
Oh, yeah.
Then they're committed to lying for eternity, really.
Yes.
You know, for them to tell the truth about the Kennedy assassination would mean to have to say we participated in a lie for the public good, but nonetheless a lie.
Uh-huh.
So that's just an example of what I mean about processes acquiring their own logic. And I think it's not been a single group, you know. When I talk about how the COG Doomsday Network has been involved, that's not always the same people. You get overlaps. There are overlaps between people in the Kennedy assassination and people in Watergate. In fact, I'd already written a manuscript about the Kennedy assassination before Watergate, and in it I had mentioned a man called Frank Fiorini, who under a different name turned up on the front page of the New York Times as one of the Watergate burglars.
Interesting. And this is Frank Sturgis.
Yes, Frank Sturgis was Frank Fiorini. And there are examples over and over and over, but there is, I think, no example of somebody involved both in the Kennedy assassination and also in 9/11. No, these are processes. The instruments are there. The machinery is there. The personnel keep changing. Cheney and Rumsfeld were definitely part of this transition in 1976 because it really happened when Donald Rumsfeld was chief of staff under Ford in the White House, and Cheney was his number one assistant. So
right.
They've been around from 1976 right through the COG planning right down to the implementation on 9/11 and the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War.
So they're key players in this sense because they were in the Ford administration during that crucial transition.
Right.
Then they were key to setting up COG in and out of government.
Right.
And then Cheney shows up as defense secretary under Bush 1 versus Saddam in Desert Storm.
Right.
So we have all that. And then later they show up in the Project for a New American Century running ads that say, you know, we need a new catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor to get people to support their vision of America.
Yes.
And America's role in the world.
Publicly for what they were planning privately.
Yes, exactly.
There is that link between PNAC and the COG planning. And there was a kind of plan brought up when Cheney was Secretary of Defense in 1992. And the deep state has many factions in it.
Okay.
Somebody thought this was too extreme and leaked it to the New York Times. And so it didn't happen in 1992. It had to wait until George W. Bush after 2001. There's one other thing about Cheney. Frequently, we have these deep events, and then we get a commission or we get an investigation. In the case of Iran-Contra, there was a joint special committee of Congress that, quote, investigated, close quote, Iran-Contra, and it was, from my point of view, largely a whitewash.
Yes.
Because they didn't really get into the drug aspect of it, which was huge. And Cheney was the senior Republican congressman on the House side of that.
Uh-huh.
And he produced a minority report at the time, which essentially said Reagan was right to do all these things, and all he violated were these post-Watergate reforms, which were terrible. We should never have had them. And that has always been – Cheney is the – of the two, Cheney was the intellectual, if you like, the theorist.
Okay.
And who frequently – again, he took – he was on a plane with a bunch of journalists, and he took time out to say how wrong Congress had been to try and establish limits and congressional restraints on the CIA. So that, yes, he has been a theorist. But this is not all attributable to one man or two men or 10 men.
I see, yeah.
The process, the deep state interferes with the public state.
Well, it's very interesting that one of the key mechanisms that the deep state likes to use to intrude on the public state is CIA operations.
First of all, one thing we have to realize is that the CIA is connected in one direction with Congress and government. But it's connected in another direction with Wall Street and Big Oil and other major U.S. international corporations. And the history of the CIA really begins on Wall Street with Alan Dulles, when he is a lawyer, drawing up a kind of charter which then goes to Washington and becomes the National Security Act. So Truman originally did not want a CIA, and when Donovan had a plan to perpetuate the OSS that was the wartime predecessor of the CIA, Truman threw it out. And eventually he accepted a CIA, but he was very careful. CIA was full of Wall Street people at the vice director level, but the head of it, Truman never chose someone from Wall Street. He always chose someone from mid-America in the western states where he himself was from. And then after Kennedy was assassinated, Truman made a very important intervention, which was immediately challenged in the media, but I think he spoke truth. He said, like 2 weeks after or so after the Kennedy assassination, said, when I set up the CIA, I never intended them to get into these covert operations.
Right.
I think history will bear him out on that.
Well, let's take a look now at how the CIA got into the business of covert operations. You know, we have the National Security Act that creates the CIA in 1947. So where's the first major covert action that sets the tone for all of these secret projects to come?
The very first covert operation was in 1948 when they put money into the Italian election to help defeat the Communist Party. Well, that was a Wall Street operation, which then the CIA took over at the insistence of Alan Dulles, who was still a lawyer on Wall Street.
Wow. So Dulles at the time didn't even have an official government position yet.
Right. And then they said, well, we're going to do this sort of thing. Well, we have to set up something. But they didn't set it up in the CIA. They set up something called the Office of Policy Coordination, which is, meaningless words.
Yeah.
And that became it immediately had a much bigger budget than the CIA. And it did a lot of really dangerous things, some of which has still never really been properly recorded, like fighting a civil war in the Ukraine, which is coming back to haunt us now in 2015 because it's at the source of the tremendous hatreds inside the Ukraine today. And they got into tension with the CIA, and the result was they said, we have to get the OPC under control. So they merged it into the CIA. Huh. And the effect of that was that it wasn't a case of the CIA taking over OPC. It was much more the opposite, that OPC came in underneath and then took over the CIA. And the CIA has been dominated by its operations officers ever since.
So could we say that the OPC was basically the covert arm of the CIA, and then at a certain point, it gets the upper hand on the entire agency?
Yes, but the CIA had a hand in controlling the OPC at the beginning, but so did the Defense Department, so did the State Department.
I see. So the OPC were really on the loose, setting up their own actions, and the CIA basically tried to get a handle on them by merging them into the agency. But it sounds like it backfired in a sense.
The CIA did not control OPC in that era. And the same head of CIA, General Beadle Smith, was adamant in calling for getting the OPC under control. It came under control into the CIA just as Eisenhower was elected president. And that meant that Alan Dulles came in as the new head of the CIA and was immediately started planning major covert operations like the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, which was a favor to the oil companies, and also the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala 1 year later in 1954, which was a favor to United Fruit and International Railways and the Schroeder brothers. But Schroeder brothers were also the bankers for Anglo-Iranian oil. So you were benefiting the same people in the deep state. Alan Dulles was the beginning of the era of major covert operations. Truman was saying, Truman was asked to authorize the overthrow of Mossadegh, and he refused. Instead, he sent Harriman to Tehran to work out a deal. And Harriman proposed what I think was the sensible deal, which was that Anglo-Iranian should split its profits with the Iranian government. And Mossadegh accepted, and Anglo-Iranian refused, because even though that's what was happening with in Saudi Arabia with Aramco and the Saudi government, the British were too stiff-necked. They didn't want to see, maybe too dependent, actually. They were pretty poor at that time. Anyway, they didn't accept it. But the important thing is that Truman is right. He didn't authorize that kind of operation. He never did.
Interesting.
He had to wait until Dulles became the DCI for those things to be the trademark of CIA.
Well, when you think about Eisenhower, who worked with Dulles and the CIA in that period, with some major intel actions going on, like Guatemala and Iran, do you think he came to see the threat of all this covert activity? Because, of course, at the end of his term, he gave a public address on television with a farewell warning about the military-industrial complex. And if we go back and watch that, you can't really find another speech with a president warning about the military the way he did.
It's interesting the way he wrote it. He didn't use his regular speech writers. It was done. It was almost a plot against the deep state to get that speech into the record. Just as the same thing with President Kennedy, you know, he made the speech which may have led to his murder in June of 63, the American University speech where he said, "We are all mortal,"
yes,
and really called for an end to the Cold War. And he, too, had to, in a very secret way, get that speech into the record. Eisenhower was leaving anyway, and Kennedy was, of course, killed 6 months, 5 months later. But Eisenhower was, I think, never a hawk. I mean, these things happened under his presidency, but I think he delegated covert operations to his vice president, a young politician called Richard Nixon, and was not very interested in what happened. A couple of key decisions came up to him, and one was whether to back the French at Dien Bien Phu and use atomic weapons. And the calls for this were coming from within his apparatus. And he was an experienced warrior, and he knew the horrors of war.
Right.
And his basic thrust was to keep big wars out of the picture. And the downside of that was he wasn't very interested in small-time covert operations, small from his point of view,
right,
overthrowing the prime minister, the elected prime minister of Iran, or the elected prime minister of Guatemala. That was just something he didn't get involved in. The key commitments that got us into war in Indochina, they, again, began under Eisenhower, but I don't think he was aware of them. In fact, the first key decision was made when he was on a golf course in Scotland playing golf as part of a priest. So why did a decision have to be made on that particular day? Because Richard Nixon could make it when Eisenhower wasn't.
Oh.
This is not the only case of that happening.
So they were using the president basically as a figurehead and leaving him out of the loop on these key decisions.
Right.
But here's what I think is interesting about this era of the deep state. We have Eisenhower warning about these forces in his speech. Then you have Truman denouncing the CIA that he set up after Kennedy is assassinated.
Right.
You know, and Truman says, "I didn't create the CIA to be this out-of-control agency." And then you have President Kennedy, who said he was going to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces. So all of these presidents who work closely with intelligence are saying that this covert influence in CIA is a threat to American freedom, basically.
Carter said that it was his policy to reduce the size and strength of the CIA, and Turner did it mostly by taking early resignations and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But there were people in the agency who felt targeted by him, rightly so. And I mentioned Shackley before. I'll mention him again.
Mm-hmm.
And Theodore Shackley, he was eased out. He wasn't exactly fired, but he was made uncomfortable. He left, and he immediately joined up with the people who were working in the Safari Club to conduct offshore operations that didn't have to go to Congress for approval.
I see.
So, and Carter is another victim, too. Yes.
Okay, so Carter also knew they were dangerous. Well, what's fascinating is this. It looks like the deep state relied on the CIA. Then, when the CIA got into trouble in the 1970s, being investigated over and over again for these unsanctioned operations, then it sounds like the Safari Club became where the focus of the deep state went, as far as intelligence is concerned anyway. So you were saying it was almost like a government in waiting, because there were these ex-CIA figures kind of biding their time and making deals, making arrangements. waiting for that chance to get back in power and to utilize that public state for their covert planning again. Does that sound correct?
Yes, pretty much. And I want to add to it something which is not mentioned enough in my book, and this again involves Shackley, that because Congress in the 70s established congressional control over the CIA, then the military started getting involved in covert operations, and they set up something called the Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC.
JSOC.
And Shackley had a hand in that, and another man called General Stilwell, who had been fired as a result of this flap back in 1952. He was fired by Beadle Smith for his involvement in Thailand.
Okay.
Went over to the military, and one of his last actions was to be an advisor in the setting up of JSOC. And what's going on now is a lot of U.S. covert operations, and not some of them not really so very covert, like the drone attacks, which was,
yes.
I mean, the planning is secret, but people, if there's a drone attack, it's not a secret. And the more and more of these things are being handled under SOCOM, Special Operations Command, and the Joint Special, JSOC, the Joint Special. There's a whole new bunch of initials in the Pentagon
right.
to deal with this kind of warfare, which is a kind of byproduct of Congress establishing oversight over the CIA.
Okay, so I think we've tracked the deep state now to the point where Carter loses re-election in 1980. Due in part to the shenanigans around the October surprise. So then when you get into the Reagan era, and you've touched on Oliver North already, but some interesting things are happening in the Reagan era. Suddenly drug traffic explodes. There are major reports implicating the CIA in drug running. So people with connections to the deep state are firmly back in power. So we have the Contras in Nicaragua running drugs. We have Barry Seal and his ties to the drug operations in MENA, Arkansas, and the Reagan administration. Now, I know you've done some amazing research on this. And so let's get into that, because I want to show how the drugs are related, financing-wise, to the deep state.
Well, yes. I don't say enough about that in this book, because I had said a lot about it in my last book.
Yeah.
But you have to remember that the dollar was under severe attack in the 70s and early 80s because of these oil price hikes.
Uh-huh.
So when Reagan was elected president, interest rates were at 17%. The economy was in a terrible mess. And the Treasury started selling bearer bonds, which meant anybody could come in for cash, buy a Treasury bond. Well, this became the number one form of laundering of drug money. And the Treasury was advised at the time, this is going to result in the laundering of drug money. They wanted the drug money. They needed an influx of capital to help bring down the interest rates and get business back to normal. And after about 6 or 7 years, they then stopped issuing bearer bonds. But the atmosphere of drugs in the U.S. economy in early 1980s isn't just the CIA. The CIA use it. They don't get the money themselves, but they work with people who finance their own private armies with drugs. And that was the case with the Contras.
Right. So they could say that basically we're getting better intelligence this way. We have to work with these kind of lower elements in these lawless places.
Right.
And that is the public explanation for what they're doing, basically.
And if it's a lawless place where you happen to be against the government, like in Nicaragua, then you work with the leading opposition, which is usually the local drug traffickers. And that was the Bermudez and people who were the head of the Contras. Well, there were different Contra factions, and there was a drug connection to every faction, because that was one of the ways of financing the Contras. And before that, you know, the largest army that the CIA ever backed was the Hmong back in the 1970s in Laos. The CIA even gave them their own airline to help. It was to get the arms in, yes, but what did those planes go out with? The single Hmong agricultural product was opium, and this airline flew it out.
Oh, right.
So it was being established, going right back to what I was talking about in the early 50s in Operation Paper. Mm-hmm. You bring arms in, and the planes bring the drugs out. And you can say we don't have anything to do with the drugs, because in the case of Operation Paper, those planes, which later were known as Air America planes, were actually 60% owned in Taiwan. So you could say, no, that's a Taiwan flight coming out. It's a CIA flight going
right,
in.
Right, right.
CIA was running the airline.
Well, you have a very interesting corollary between the drug traffic around the Vietnam War and then Afghanistan, which is the new drug war. And to a certain extent, both of these conflicts were drug wars.
Exactly. I would say that I do say in my book, one of my books, it's a rerun of Laos.
Okay.
Yes. And, you know, we get a lot in the papers about how the Taliban are financing themselves by drugs, and they are. But everybody in Afghanistan, and certainly the established government, that is the major part of the Afghan economy, just as before it was the major part of the Laotian economy. And the head of the Laotian army was also the head of the Laotian drug agency, but drugs were actually legal. The only difference is that drugs until 1971 were legal in Laos, whereas they were illegal in Afghanistan. But that, of course, is good for prices. That helps prices go up.
Well, one of the most interesting details that you point out, actually, is that under Taliban rule in Afghanistan, drug production had gone way down, which is amazing. Oh.
Virtually eliminated. Yes, in one year, bang.
Wow.
There was some drug production, but it all came from the areas which were not yet were never controlled by the Taliban up in the north. The northeast was the drug producing area in that period. And that was those people became our allies against the Taliban.
So we're basically allying ourselves with the drug cartel in Afghanistan versus the Taliban.
As we did. Yes, exactly.
Right. That's fascinating. And after we got into Afghanistan, of course, suddenly the drug production level is off the charts again.
Yes, and is again now. It's huge. I don't have the figures for this year, but it went, it more than doubled from the highest year before Karzai went in. And initially, you could almost say there was a humanitarian justification for it, because the country was so wrecked by 10 years of civil war that if people had not been able to grow drugs, they would have starved.
Okay.
So maybe for a year or two, you can justify allowing the drug traffic.
I see.
We've been there for over a decade, and we're going to leave the country the number one heroin producer in the world, which it wasn't before the CIA became involved in it. It's very interesting, though. When we were involved in Southeast Asia, that was the number one opium area producing in the world. And when Nixon recognized China and cut his connections with Taiwan, and then the drug production there plummeted, at the same time, it started rising in Afghanistan. And actually, the levels, or total levels, are not all that different. I believe that there are very powerful drug forces in the world, that the CIA, they don't control these forces, but they are working with these forces. And what's interesting is that the drugs started going up in Afghanistan, and there, sooner or later, sure enough, the CIA turned up
right.
for the first time in a big way in Afghanistan. Now, Brzezinski was the advisor to Carter who authorized operations, which he himself said may lead to a Russian intervention in the Civil War. I don't know that Brzezinski knew anything about the drugs. But I think that in the deep state, there are forces that saw this whole thing coming and were able, in other words, eliminating the drugs in Southeast Asia didn't have the effect of eliminating the drug traffic. It had the effect of moving it. And the same thing has happened with cocaine in Latin America. You know, George H.W. Bush proclaimed a war on drugs in Latin America, in specifically in Colombia. And I predicted in 1990, I said, if we start this war, I predict that we will have more cocaine and not less. And within 10 years, my prediction was borne out. Wow. Cocaine production trebled in Colombia. You want it to go down? End the drug war. But they don't want to end the drug war because it is part of the establishment of how America has a presence in the rest of the world. And yes, we need, one of my chapters is America must end its self-generating wars. What war is a self-generating war? Because you're driving profits up and more people come in. And the war on terrorism is a self-generating war because you create 10 terrorists for everyone that you murder with a drone attack.
Yes, absolutely. Well, before we leave this topic of drugs, and this is so interesting, recently there was a movie that came out based on a true story about journalist Gary Webb called Kill the Messenger. And of course, anyone into tracking this subject knew about Webb long before the movie came out because of his excellent book, Dark Alliance, where he outlined how elements in the CIA were running drugs into major American cities. And the movie came under nonstop attack in the mainstream media.
Yes, I was actually a consultant.
Oh, that's great. Well, you really know that story.
And I'm proud to say that one of my recommendations was adopted in the movie.
Excellent.
It's a very good movie. It's pretty true to, if I'm asked to say, is it essentially true? I would say, yes, it's essentially true. Why is it being attacked in the media? Because the media attacked Gary Webb. And they destroyed Gary Webb. They put him in a position where he couldn't make any money, and I think it was a suicide.
Yeah.
But it was a suicide of a man who had no income, who was starving.
Yes, I understand what you mean, that there are ways to eliminate someone without actually planning out their assassination.
Totally, yes.
Yeah, sure. But when you think about Webb, first of all, for the person who's watching this and doesn't really know much about media manipulation, why would the media want to destroy a figure like Gary Webb, who was exposing this shady network between Central American drug running and intelligence operations and potentially being involved with shipping crack into Los Angeles? Why would the media have a vested interest in taking a guy like that down?
Well, what are called the mainstream media and I call the governing media are media that work very closely with the CIA, and hardly a day goes by when you don't see a story from Washington that says a high-level official who declined to be identified said, that's the CIA putting stuff into the media.
Okay.
And the media, if you want to be an important newspaper, you depend on that connection. And the CIA does favors for the media by giving them stories that the media then thing, and the media defends the CIA, not 100% of the time, but most of the time they do. And in the case of Gary Webb, the CIA later boasted how they put out advisories to things to say about Gary Webb, and the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, they all chipped in and attacked Gary Webb, particularly scandalous in the case of the L.A. Times, because Gary Webb relied very heavily on an L.A. Times story, Ricky Ross, the King of Crack in L.A.
Right.
He used that story, and then the same reporter working for the L.A. Times then attacked Webb and said, that's a great exaggeration, the things you claim for Ricky Ross. And that same reporter, I believe, since then has somewhat repented and apologized for having played this double role. I had this same experience with some of the people that are mentioned in the Gary Webb book, because my job But I worked for a little think tank in Washington in 87, and a part of it was doing research and sending stuff up to I didn't deal much with Kerry. I dealt with mostly with his executive assistant on the committee. But I also did stories to give to the press. And I began to see a pattern. These people would say, oh, yes, we're very interested. And is there anything more you know? Tell us. No, we're going to do a huge story. And then they wouldn't do the story. And the people who wouldn't do the story were the people who became the character assassins dealing with Gary Webb a few weeks later. I mean, I'm not going to name names, but I could name names. And that's their job. You know, they work for a newspaper that is part of a control system. And I think I have a small apology in my book where I say I haven't dealt with all of the aspects of the deep state because I wanted very much to look at corporations and the intervening, mm-hmm. the level of the public state and the level of the CIA and the NSA. Up at the very top, you have the corporations and the banks. And in between those are these consulting firms like Booz Allen Hamilton, which are full of people who come from the CIA and go back to the CIA or go back to industry, come from industry. They're all interacting.
And this is private intelligence contracting agencies.
Yes, I call them, you know, we have private military corporations. We have private intelligence corporations. Anyway, I don't say enough about the media because that was going in a slightly different direction. But they are part of the deep state,
uh-huh.
and they have their own, you know, Ben Magdickian and people who have written about how the corporatization of the media, that it all focuses in the end on Wall Street, and people who are on the boards of the media are on the boards of the big corporations and the banks, and that is the deep state. The media are as much part of the deep state as, say, Booz Allen Hamilton is part of the deep state.
Yeah, well, you have these major media companies and TV stations in New York, along with the national newspapers there.
Right.
And we have Wall Street right in the middle of all that. And you're saying they intertwine very closely and are really part of the same mindset.
Yeah, well, I have to be careful. I'm not saying this to you. I'm saying to myself.
Oh, yeah.
You have to be very careful when you talk about the mindset because you often see conflicts. I mean, Rupert Murdoch and News Corp and Fox News, they're on a slightly different path from, say, the New York Times and CBS News.
Right.
And when Rupert Murdoch's family got into some big trouble in England over crimes, the New York Times did a lot to expose that. So
there
isn't exactly a single mindset uniting Rupert Murdoch with the New York Times, but if somebody's coming from outside and challenging the whole thing, like a Gary Webb on drugs,
okay,
then they will unite to deal with him. No, they don't necessarily unite. And I think sometimes seriously disagree on should Iran, for example. I think you do find some serious differences. The PNAC view on what to do in Iran is not, I think, the New York Times view of what to do on Iran. And this is a very complex and interesting area, which I may have to write a second book about or something.
Yeah. Well, I hope that you do, because I think it's important to see that the media doesn't tell us the truth. You know, too many people take it for granted that they will. But even when the media is reporting and following up on an important story, we're not getting the whole truth. You know, they're not really showing us the deeper levels.
I think somewhere I compare the media performance in the Iraq war with the media performance in the Vietnam war. The media, you know, is basically people rather like me. I mean, all my life I've known journalists, and they're usually rather decent people, but like bureaucrats, anyone who works for an organization learns either to think the way the organization thinks or to get out. That's why I got out of government. I was beginning to think like a bureaucrat, and I could see myself beginning to think as a bureaucrat when I left.
But well, I think there's no question that there's a real danger of being absorbed.
Some very good friends stayed in, and they continue to be my good friends, even though they held to views which I now radically disagreed with. Journalists are in that situation, and many good journalists have had to leave. We have one of the results is that there's now a spectrum between the governing media and people like me. There are a lot of intermediate figures like Robert Parry, for example, who broke the story on Contras and drugs, and he broke a number of other stories. And people who were breaking stories back in that era were eased out of the media, and he now has something called Consortium News, which is an excellent self-supporting news agency. He doesn't agree with me about 9/11. He's blasting people who say that there's a conspiracy behind 9/11. But so he's in an intermediate position.
I see.
I'm very glad he's there, and he's been very good on the Ukraine and on U.S.-Russian relations. And
well, it's interesting. And this reminds me of someone like Bill Moyers, who plays a very dual role, you know, because you could say Bill Moyers on one side of things was an insider, a special assistant to LBJ, and had a deep connection and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. But he also did some incredible work
yes.
as a journalist, exposing a lot of political corruption in a special documentary. And this is quite a while ago now, but it was called The Secret Government.
I was supposed to be a major source for that movie. The producers told me 1 week before that I was going to be have a big role in that movie. And when I watched it, there were the things I had said, but somebody else said them.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
I think I'm not really a totally acceptable person to the media.
Yeah.
And I'm bad. I mean, I'm happier to be where I am than to be somebody reading somebody else's lines.
No, I understand that. And since you've mentioned it, actually, I've seen your work plagiarized so often when dealing with covert political reporting and just used in a variety of ways.
I want it to be disseminated.
Yeah, but this is without sourcing it or saying who they're getting it from. You know, most of the time people don't credit it back to your body of research. And I'll see it pop up in everything from New York Times articles to, you know, New World Order websites. And sometimes it's word for word based on your books on deep politics.
Well, I'm not alone. There are other people like me, and we're all in this situation. Bill Moyers, for example, he had an excellent show with a man called Lofgren about the deep state.
Right.
Now, I didn't mention that I used the deep state in 2007, but no, I want the idea of the deep state to get out there, so I'm quite happy not to be cited.
I know what you mean. And actually, it is a fascinating thing. You know, when I saw this guy going around with his book on the deep state, I said, oh, they must be interviewing Professor Scott. You know, that's the first thing that popped into my head. But when I watched the shows, he was only talking about Republicans and Democrats and all that, you know, nothing edgy and just a totally different version of the whole thing. But using the title, the same title from your books.
You know, I'm not against it. There's a book out almost simultaneously with mine. A man called Michael Glennon has brought about a book out called National Security and Double Government. He's talking about what I would call the two outer layers of the deep state onion. He's talking about Congress, the president at one level, and then the CIA, what he calls, I think, the Trumanite network, because he blames Truman for setting these things up. He doesn't, I guess, take very seriously Truman's claim that he didn't intend to what has since happened. It's a good book, but he doesn't talk about Wall Street. He doesn't talk about banks. He doesn't talk about drug trafficking. He's a political scientist.
Uh-huh.
He's talking about structures. And in my own book, Michael Lofgren says, is it Michael? Yeah, I think so. Lofgren says that the deep state is like an iceberg, and you only see the top level of it that goes way, way down. And that's a good metaphor in terms of suggesting the sort of size of the problem we're dealing with, but it's a bad metaphor because the deep state is not a structure. It's not something solid like an iceberg at the end. And I distinguish between the structures. Now, the CIA is a structure. Congress is a structure. But when you're talking about Wall Street, it's not a structure in the same sense. And so I talk there about a system, a solar system, or even better, a weather system.
A weather system, yeah.
A weather system is something you can't precisely say where it stops and where it ends, but it can be very forceful. And it can you can have a Hurricane Sandy, and it can be devastating.
Right.
So I think we're dealing with forces that are not all structured and are not predictable. They interact in different ways.
I see. That's very interesting. Well, in your new book, you talk about how over time it has come down to two different worldviews, really, with two competing mentalities. And so on one side, we have a kind of bottom-up democracy versus a top-down empire.
Right.
Now, can we talk a little bit about that? Because it seems to me to be the foundation of the book, really, the clash of these two intense forces.
Yes, well, that's a thought that I took from Hannah Arendt. And actually, to be really honest, I took it from a man called Jonathan Schell, who adapted Hannah Arendt's ideas into a powerful defense of nonviolence and the vision that the bottom-up powers, the powers of persuasion as opposed to the powers of coercion, mm-hmm. are growing. And in my last chapter, I come back to that theme and say that I believe the long... See, many of my friends here in Berkeley, the left coast,
yes,
they're very depressed about America. And I'm not nearly... I'm a Canadian, first of all. I don't take heart. I don't get as depressed as Americans do when things go wrong in this country because, yes, I'm involved and I care deeply, but I'm also part of me sees it a bit from outside. And looking from outside, I see that America has had this kind of crisis before. We really are in a period of mania, insanity,
uh-huh.
in right now. America's gone crazy about terrorism and is responding in ways which are increasing the terrorism. And some people are very happy to do that because it's intensely profitable to some people. But America's been in periods of mania before and has rectified itself.
Yes. Well, what are some of the self-perpetuating factors that are keeping America in this off-balance state?
We have a very small percentage who are profiting at obscene rates from what's going on right now. And we have many people say we have a new Gilded Age, referring to the late 19th century. But America took care of that. It took a Republican president.
Right.
And after starting with Theodore Roosevelt, income disparity and wealth disparity in this country began diminishing and diminishing and diminishing. And that was true right up until 1980 and the Reagan Revolution, when it started going back very radically in the opposite direction.
Uh-huh.
Well, I believe that the long-term process of history, and this is sharing my idea from Jonathan Schell, that in the long run, the forces of persuasion are increasing. They were nothing to begin with. History for a long time was not a history of persuasion. It was a history of coercion.
True.
But we've had events in American history recently. One of them was the anti-war movement that essentially from below helped, not by itself, of course, but helped persuade America to get out of Vietnam. A much more inspiring example is the civil rights movement.
Yes.
Essentially, it was a movement of persuasion. It persuaded whites in the South that they did not want, that it was not in their interest to perpetuate Jim Crow and the prevention of Negroes from voting. It was in their interest to be part of the world as a whole, which disapproved so radically of that situation.
Right.
So that's my last chapter, that the long trend in history is persuasion dominating, whereas in the short term, it's usually coercion dominating, and right now it is coercion dominating. But that is self-defeating, I think, not permanent.
I see. It's their short-term solution, but you see it's historically.
Term, but is short-term. Yes, shorter than the other.
Right. So you're saying historically, America has a chance to turn things around.
America is not, you know, I hear some people saying America is a fascist country. No, it's full of people. I mean, in a fascist country, you and I wouldn't be talking on TV.
That's true. And it's important that we are very specific when we use terms like that. I agree 100%. But on the other hand, we are talking about trends here, like the militarization of the police that you referenced earlier and the privacy violations we see happening in contracting agencies for intelligence. So what do you see are some of the biggest dangers going on, you know, in addition to what we've covered here so far?
Well, I think it's the accumulation of wealth in the hands of very few people. And so that particularly since the Supreme Court decision, where money now can turn up anywhere. And that in the short run, I think we will see this Keystone Pipeline, which is a disaster from an environmental point of view. So the money problem is so acute that you might say that's a difference between now and the Theodore Roosevelt era, that America was able to right itself because there wasn't money concentrated in, say, 100 people or something like that. I've heard it said, I don't know if it's true or not, but that the richest people in the country all know each other or are in touch with each other. And if that's true, they can throw their money. But even so, we're still seeing divisions. You know, I mean, one of the largest fortunes squandered in the last election was somebody who was spending his own private money, about $60 million of it, to support candidates who were willing to speak truth to power on the question of global warming.
Yeah.
And in the short run, he lost, but he didn't really lose all that money. It was a step in a process that someday, I mean, either we're going to get smart about global warming or it's the end. You know, it's not, the culture we're in now is not maintainable unless it can readjust its relationship to the forces of nature.
So I can see from what you're saying that you do have a kind of central optimism for America. And after all, the book is called American Deep State. So you're speaking specifically about America in there.
Yes.
But the trends that you're seeing in America, like you said before, you know, we're in a kind of mania now.
Right.
And, you know, it's almost like McCarthyism or other stressful periods where the official structure just overreached. And, you know, another example would be the anti-war movement.
Yes, or at 1919 in the Palmer Raids, which was a blot on U.S. history, but it ended up with Hoover being told not to do that sort of thing. And
right. Well,
I mean, it's a complex story again, but yes, there are things. The short term, but reading the paper from day to day, one is rationally, I think, compelled to be a pessimist.
Okay.
But reading American history in the long run, there's room for hope, not so much for a rational prediction that things will go well, but there's room for a hope that they will go well, a room for faith that America is a much better country than the present government we now have, Democrat or Republican. And room for to love this country, which I do. I mean, I'm here by choice. I love it. Unfortunately, they've never deported me. So I see so much advantage here that we are all, I think, very fortunate to be in this country, which gives us the opportunity to try and change this country. And that's the whole idea of what America is, a project, a way to make the city on the hill come into being. Anyone who says we are the city on the hill is a liar.
Right.
But we have the chance to become it. Yes, I think America, I say in one place that I'm an exceptionalist as a Canadian. I see America as being exceptionalist. I think it was exceptional when it created the Constitution, which was a beam of light to Europe and other parts of the world. And we're exceptional now in the number of prisoners we have in our jails.
Yeah.
And the number of people below the poverty line. I mean, it's a bad moment in otherwise generally noble, if imperfect, history.
Definitely. I can appreciate that. There's no question that greatness lies in our power if we can start to take control of these institutions that really need to be answerable to people and also expose these deep state forces that are usurping the public interest.
Right.
Well, Professor, moving into our final segment, and it's just extraordinary what you've shared here today. I noticed that you started the American Deep State book with a fantastic quote by Frank Church.
Yes.
Of course, Church was the senator from Idaho who challenged the intelligence services and formed the Church Committee to look into their activities in the 70s. I was curious why you chose him and this particular powerful quote. So let's play the quote first, and then when we come back, you can tell me why you chose it.
Yeah.
I know the capacity that is there to make tyranny total in America, and we must see to it that this agency, the National Security Agency, and all agencies that possess this technology operate within the law and under proper supervision so that we never cross over that abyss. That is the abyss from which there is no return.
Well, you know, when I come back to deal with Church in the body of the book, it's in a context of what I see was a very important period in American history between 1960 and 1980 or more narrowly between the Kennedy assassination and the successful efforts of CIA, ex-CIA agents to prevent the re-election of Jimmy Carter. Frank Church represented a kind of threat to the deep state at that time because America was in chaos, really chaos as a result of the Vietnam War, student protests, black riots in the ghettos. And then we have Watergate, and in the shambles after Watergate, it was unclear what direction America would go in. After the Vietnam War, would we reduce the defense budget and go back to the kind of civilian economy we had before? Or would we alternatively move to an extended military economy and just offshore the manufacturing that used to be done domestically? And you could say that Frank Church represented the best hopes in Congress to go in the direction by exposing things that, when I say the deep state, I mean, of course, the CIA, the FBI. He never, I think, wrote very much about the NSA, but he did look at it, and he was very alarmed by what he saw. And Congress, he brought in legislation to Congress, some of which is very relevant now, like the National Emergencies Act, which said, if the president proclaims an emergency, Congress has to review it within 6 months. Well, after 9/11, the president did proclaim an emergency, and that was 14 years ago, and Congress has never renewed it.
Right.
Anyway, Church saw the problems, and he offered a solution, and I sincerely believe that if Carter had been reelected, there was a good chance that there would have been more legislation, but that didn't happen because elements of the deep state, and specifically in my book, I name the oil companies, together with the so-called October surprise counterplot of the Republicans, which involved not just ex-CIA agents, but also people from Israel and from Iran. What happened at the end of those two decades is that the deep state, having been challenged by Church and others, emerged actually because there was a struggle at that time, and essentially the deep state won the struggle. So starting with the Reagan Revolution, it's a thesis of my book, that the deep state has been in much more powerful position than before. And we're talking something like the Kennedy assassination. That was a deep state act against the public state. But since the Reagan Revolution, the deep state has been so ensconced in the public state that you haven't seen those kind of tensions between them that we saw so vividly between 1960 and 1980.
Yes, and that's very compelling. One of the things you point out is that the presidency itself got into major problems when the deep state got the upper hand after the JFK assassination, and that the presidency didn't really regain its footing until Reagan was elected in 1980, and the deep state was finally at peace to have Reagan in there.
Exactly. I mean, if we look at the fates of presidents, Kennedy was assassinated. Johnson was going to run for a second term, and then he's having so much trouble with the military that he didn't. Nixon was elected for two terms, but he had to resign. And that was, I believe, Watergate has never yet been fully understood, that it was essentially a right-wing plot against Nixon preparing for the Reagan Revolution. And then you had Carter, and he was, Ford.
Ford.
An incumbent president was defeated, the first one since Hoover in 1932, and Carter became the second incumbent to be defeated. So it was a bad time, you know, for the presidency and for the country. I mean, it wasn't all the deep state. There were problems. I mean, losing a war is a traumatic event. I mean, in France, it was the end of the Fourth Republic. So we didn't have anything quite as violent as that.
Uh-huh.
But we had cultural shocks from all of the confusion at that time, which have changed the country. And some of those changes weren't fully implemented until 9/11. But we are now in a different country from where we were in the 50s.
Well, that's definitely true. And I think the direction we're heading in now is not too promising, not currently anyway. Finally, Professor, I was hoping to have you share this very interesting personal anecdote of a strange incident that happened to you and Alfred McCoy, also a great author.
Yes.
And so I believe this takes place in the 70s, and someone had called you and informed you that they had some special information they wanted to share with you.
Actually, I called them.
Okay.
This is the opening of the American war machine. Yes, it is a personal anecdote, and it's a deep event, but a very small one.
Right.
Al McCoy and I both came out with books mentioning the CIA and the drug traffic in 1972. And my book was a book that you could not find in bookstores, and his book became very much thing. Both of us actually got some help from people in the CIA. What happened here was I had gone to a winter soldier hearing earlier, or about a few months earlier, and heard somebody talk about loading bales or watching bales of opium being loaded onto Air America planes, CIA planes. And when Al came out, he went to Laos and did magnificent work. I mean, his book had a lot of stuff in it, way beyond mine. On his way to Laos, he stayed with me here in Berkeley. And I had the number of the man who had talked about seeing these bales of opium being loaded on a plane. And I said, would you be willing to talk to the two of us tomorrow? And he said, sure. He was in Palo Alto, not far away. So we had that phone call. And as far as I know, there had never been any thought of this happening until Al came out and I suggested it and I made the phone call. And then the next morning we got in the car, we drove to Palo Alto. And as I remember it, and by the way, I completely forgot about this. So I'll come back to that.
Uh-huh.
But as I now recall it, we went up the stairs, knocked on his door, and he came out like this, motioning to be silent, and then pointing down the stairs. We went back down the stairs. We came to his red MG, and there was a hole this big in the steel door of his MG, like this. And then he pointed to the flooring in his MG, which was wood. And he said, and now he's talking, he got away from his house, and he says, look at the floor, it is barely scorched. He said, that had to be an implosion device set by some of the people in my old unit.
Huh.
So what does this mean? This means that somebody overheard our phone conversation, and it ended up with somebody blowing a hole in his door in order to terrorize him into not talking, because he wouldn't say a word to us, because he had been given the message. Now, the real reason I tell that story is not just to say that there's an interaction between people who listen to phone calls and people who blow holes in doors, but the reaction of Al and me. I was writing about what's wrong with this country. I didn't remember that memory. I completely suppressed that memory because it was just too big to fit with everything else in my mind. And I didn't recover it until about 20 years later. I was writing a poem called Coming to Jakarta, which the subtitle of which appropriately is a poem about terror. And without getting into the subject matter of too much of the thing, I was recovering memories that I had suppressed. And I realized that we all live by suppressing memories. And that's how we stay sane, because there's so much in the world that would drive us insane if we took it seriously. Just the poverty of people in this country, for example.
Yes.
I mean, we don't really keep that in our minds. It's an intolerable situation. Well, I recovered the memory myself by writing the poem. The next time I saw Al, I asked him about it to see if he had suppressed it. And as I was pretty sure, he had suppressed it too. And to this day, his memory, the latest edition of his masterpiece book, The Politics of Heroin, deals with this episode by quoting my poem.
Wow.
That's a way of dealing with it. So that there are things we repress that we have to recover. That's why I began by saying that, yes, the deep politics is the product of a system of society which is so unjust that we repress a great deal of what's going on. And the process towards a more healthy, open society will be to recover the repressed memories that will undo some of the products of that repression, like the state of emergency we're in right now, for example, to bring it up to the present. So I think that's the anecdote you wanted, and that's why I think it is a really sort of, it represents in a small way, because it was a deep event. I don't understand it fully. I don't think it was CIA. Remember, I said the CIA was actually giving us information because it was 1971 is the year that Nixon is about to recognize, go to Beijing and lead to a normalization of China. And that will mean cutting connections to the Kuomintang drug traffickers in Southeast Asia. But somebody didn't like what was going on.
Amazing. That's just so off the charts and really shows you how these people operate. Now, you've had to endure a fair amount of surveillance also for dealing with these sensitive political subjects.
I was then, but they didn't make a secret of it then. I think I still am, but they're more sophisticated now.
Sure.
There was a case where an email with some sensitive material disappeared out of my mailbox. In my computer.
Yeah, okay.
And simultaneously with the email I'd sent to somebody else. That's how I learned, because it disappeared from his mailbox.
Oh.
And he asked me about it, and I said, well, I'll give it to you again. It was gone from my mailbox.
Mm.
That's a pretty tiny thing. I mean, I don't feel oppressed by that.
And you've shared the information at this point, so the books are out there.
Yeah.
They know what you're about.
I want the surveillance. I've always said this. I want them to know what I'm doing because I'm nonviolent.
Yes.
If I became a citizen, I would swear not to overthrow the government by violence, and I would probably also swear to try to overthrow it by nonviolence. But I'm not going to become a citizen, so it's not relevant.
Yes.
But I want them to know, I want the CIA and the FBI and the government to know, I'm not happy about having a private intelligence corporation do surveillance on me, SAIC, for example, because for them there's a profit motive. If they say this man is dangerous and we need to up the surveillance on him, it's profitable for them.
Definitely.
So that's going to contaminate their reporting on me. But if it's the FBI and the CIA, go ahead. I read my computer. There's nothing in there that would get me arrested, I think.
It's interesting that you mentioned a private intelligence corporation doing surveillance. You know, my mind jumps to Blackwater, which is called Academy now with an I at the end. Of course, we use those guys a lot in Iraq, and even though they got into a lot of trouble when their people were just out of control over there, but Obama still contracts with them for hundreds of millions of dollars. But you've done a lot of research that's very intriguing on their founder and his family connections. Do you recall this?
Oh, yes. Eric Prince, we're talking about.
Right.
He comes from a staunchly Republican family. He married into another staunchly Republican family. And I think it was his wife's family, some member of it, boasted that they had given more money to the Republican Party than any other family. So what this really meant was by outsourcing government money to Blackwater, you were generating profits, which then came back in to reinforce the mindset that wants to have lots of government operations overseas. So that's the danger of this.
I see. Yeah.
You know, the military-industrial complex, when Eisenhower wrote about it, it was important, but it wasn't the dominant economy. He wrote it with, I'm sure, the encouragement of people from the civilian economy who shared this concern that the military economy was eroding and corrupting the civilian economy. And look what's happened. Now, all of our manufacturing, virtually the old manufacturing, has gone overseas. And the people who are architects of that were people who were part of this story of the deep state that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But it was still a competition. Now it's not a competition. Now we are a militarized economy. And to fight our way out of that is not going to be easy. But luckily, we still are incredibly rich in this country with innovators.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm on the edge of it here in Berkeley. Across the bay is Silicon Valley and Stanford.
Oh, yeah.
We have to draw on all that kind of energy and apply it to not to the problem of tracking down poor, impoverished Muslims in the northwest provinces of Pakistan. Apply it to the problem of global warming and alternative energy.
Yes, well, you make a great point that we need to use these advances in technology to make a better world and not misuse this kind of opportunity.
Yes.
And that's what's so great about your new book, because it really is the culmination of all your fearless investigating over the years with all that incredible research that you've done. And on that note, I wanted to tell you that I found a clip of you interviewing Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry on the grassy knoll. Now, this is a classic clip from the 70s, and you were asking him about what happened there. And he was in charge of the JFK investigation originally.
Yes, he was in the car.
Right. So we're going to play that clip, but first I wanted to ask you if you remember that day and interviewing him.
Well, I have to respond two ways. First of all, you never let me, you don't give me time to say you're exaggerating when you say I'm fearless and things like that, but I'm not very fearless, no. I do fairly safe things. And I just want to comment about that camera that took that interview. It was a camera from Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, or no, excuse me, the National Film Board.
Okay.
In Canada. Because, again, no American network would have allowed that sort of thing. It showed on Canadian television and actually showed the, I don't know what parts of the show were taken up, but parts of the show were shown in Britain, France, Germany,
yeah,
all over the world, except, of course, in the United States.
Unbelievable.
A public broadcasting station took an option on the show and sat on it forever. And so America was the one country which was not allowed to see that film of Street Kelly.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, let's see what they were trying to hide. Here's the clip of you and Chief Curry. Here we go.
Approximately right along here, I would say.
Did you, you didn't look back at that point?
No, I looked in the rear view mirror. Mm-hmm.
I see. Now, you've seen the Zapruder film that was taken from up this hill. And there's a very distinct head snap where the President Kennedy's head is hit backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that suggest that the shot would have come from the
Well, it would appear to be. So,
And at the same, we also have Dr. Malcolm Perry at Parkland Hospital saying that he examined the wound in the president's throat and it was an entrance wound.
Yes.
Which would also suggest that the shot had come from the front.
I'm not saying the shot was not fired from here. I'm saying we never found anybody that we could connect with it.
But it does suggest that the evidence
right.
that we have, it's in both cases rather strong evidence, that there was another assassin.
That's right.
But that won't be mine.
This and all previous episodes of the show are available from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune by Billy Bragg and Wilco has lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Now, if you'd like to help as a reader for future episodes, do get in touch, drop me a line, or if you would like to give feedback on the show, my email address is unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. Listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. From Pearl Harbor to Hiroshima. In common history, Pearl Harbor and Hiroshima represent the beginning and the end events of World War II, suggesting that the attack on Pearl Harbor forced the U.S. into war and that the bombing of Hiroshima saved the lives of 1.5 to 1 million U.S. soldiers. With help from long-ignored or classified information, Arjun Makhijani reanalyzes both events. Makhijani holds a PhD in engineering with focus on nuclear fusion from the University of California, Berkeley. He has written books and articles on the nuclear fuel cycle, weapons production, testing, workers' exposure to radiation, and nuclear waste. He also wrote the groundbreaking book, Carbon-Free and Nuclear-Free, a roadmap for U.S. energy policy, the first analysis of a transition to a U.S. economy based completely on renewable energy. Makhijani is president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. The website is ieer.org. And he has 3 decades of activism for disarmament. 2 names come up in the first minutes of this talk, and the audience from Nuke Free Now knew exactly why. However, it's not widely known that the physicist Albert Einstein, on August 2, 1939, signed a letter to President Roosevelt. So here's a little additional background. Written by Leo Szilard, Einstein's former student, that letter stated that recent research had proven that a new powerful bomb could be built using the nuclear chain reaction, and that Germany had access to uranium, as well as the know-how to build such a bomb. Historians write that that letter helped motivate Roosevelt to authorize the formation of the Advisory Committee on Uranium. This committee became one of the precursors to the Manhattan Project that actually built the bombs. The scientists drafted into the Manhattan Project were told that the goal was to prevent Germany from building the bomb and to use the bomb to stop Hitler. The question then became, why did all but one scientist continue to work on the bombs after it became clear in December 1944 that there was no viable bomb project in Germany? That one lone scientist was Joseph Rotblat. He was born in Poland and became a naturalized British physicist. He shared the 1995 Nobel Prize for Nuclear Disarmament. Makhijani mentions Einstein and Rotblat in the opening of his talk, From Pearl Harbor to Hiroshima. He is Arjun Makhijani.
I have found a resistance from those who commemorate Hiroshima and Nagasaki to talking about Pearl Harbor. So every 6th of August, we have this ritual, and I have been less and less inclined to participate in this ritual because one side says the Japanese militarists were horrible and they were murderous, vicious killers, and they bombed Pearl Harbor and started the war, and it was necessary to save American lives, and the other side says the war was essentially over, and it was a message to the Soviet Union, and there's some truth to all of these things. And so disarmament folks are afraid to talk about Pearl Harbor, as I have understood, because they feel that, you know, if you say the Japanese were militarists, it might somehow justify the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I'll give you a hint of my own position, which I'll clarify at the end. Had I been here in 1939, I'm not that old, I do not believe I would have had more wisdom than Einstein. Einstein was not only a great physicist, he was a great man and a very thoughtful social justice and peace activist. And he wrote this letter. He signed the letter, actually drafted by Leo Szilard. Many Jews from Europe, they looked to Hitler, and they were quite alarmed after fission was discovered. And you know that history, so I won't dwell on it. But I personally, I just want to tell you, I don't think I would have had more moral vision than he did. He regretted it after the war. He regretted having written that letter. And then I hope that I would have had the courage of the greatest scientist in the Manhattan Project. And in my lights, the greatest scientist in the Manhattan Project was Joe Rotblat. Joe Rotblat quit the Manhattan Project in early December 1944 when it became known from the ALSO spy mission to Europe that Germany did not have a viable bomb project, and so there was no threat from Hitler's bomb, and he felt his job was done. And he quit, but he was the only one. And so you don't know whether you have the moral courage, but it tells you what I wish for myself. All right. I don't want to start the story at Pearl Harbor, because normally it does. I want to make a bigger argument. I want to get out of this ritual, both for us who want to see nuclear disarmament. And I'm completely with you on that and have worked for nuclear disarmament for quite a long time. And I also want, especially here, the Los Alamos scientists to get out of their ritual and the broader society to get out of their ritual. So history did not start with Pearl Harbor. You have to ask, was the fleet based there since the U.S. conquered Hawaii? What was the U.S. doing in Hawaii, and when did the fleet go there? It turns out that the fleet went there in 1940. It was actually based in San Diego. So that's one sort of pretty big question. The anterior question is, why did the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor, and did it have a relation to the fleet being there and having been sent there? And what were these two powers doing, dueling each other? They were doing a kind of a complicated kabuki dance for 50 years. So a brief history. After the Meiji Restoration in the mid-19th century in Japan, they started looking out to the world, and their eyes fell on a fellow island nation halfway around the world, which had occupied my country, where I come from. And they thought, this is a pretty good deal. You can get raw materials and cheap labor from others. And like Britain actually has more resources, or had more resources than Japan. Britain had quite a lot of coal, and they could actually fuel their fleet. Japan does not have significant raw material and fuel resources. And so the early project of the Japanese imperialists was, of course, conquest, like all imperialists in those days. And they captured Korea, they waged war on Russia, they won, and at that point they were recognized as a global power by the West. They were big boys. They made an alliance with the British, the Anglo-Japanese alliance. They were actually allies of the British in World War I. Some of you may not know that. And so their ambitions were just as violent. I was going to show you pictures of Japanese imperial violence, of British imperial violence, of the Nazi violence. And the Nazi violence was also, it was the outgrowth of a pathological state that had lost its imperial colonies and was seeking to reestablish them. That's how I understand Nazism. And the whole rightward drift of imperialist powers when they lose ill-gotten resources. The United States, of course, had reached the limit of the continental shores in that same period. And here's a speech that Senator Beveridge made, a small excerpt of it. I recommend you go to the web and read the whole thing. In the U.S. Senate, January 9th, 1900. So by this time, the Japanese are already significant imperial powers in Eastern Asia. They are expanding. They're about to wage war on Russia. All imperial powers are somehow in China, Germany, France, Britain, United States. Mr. President, the times call for candor. The Philippines are ours forever. You know, this is just after the U.S.-Spanish War. Territory belonging to the United States, as the Constitution calls them, and just beyond the Philippines are China's illimitable markets. We will not renounce our part in the mission of our race, trustee under God of the civilization of the world. And it goes on. You please focus on that last phrase. Civilization of the world. It will come back in the nuclear context. Between 1860 and 1920, there were many, many famines in India. Of course, usually there were some meteorological causes, but India was a major food exporter. Any Irish Americans here? So you will understand this best, that during these times of shortage, British continued to export food. And if you see the pictures, it will remind you of another Holocaust, more recent. It's estimated by an American researcher that between 30 and 60 million people were killed in famines between 1860 and 1920. But Churchill was not yet involved. But Churchill did preside over a famine in India during World War II, and he refused to let his British people who said you have to declare famine and we will do famine relief. No, he wanted all resources directed toward the British war effort, even in India. And here's a couple of quotes from somebody who is legitimately a hero to the British, which I acknowledge, but unfortunately not a hero to me. "I hate Indians," he said. "They are a beastly people with a beastly religion." And then November 1942, more pertinent. Some of you may not agree with that, I know. "I have not become the king's first minister in order to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire." So this will also come back. So in 1931, the Japanese invaded Manchuria, and in 37, they invaded China. You've heard about the Nanking massacres and many atrocities and so on. But there were other imperial powers involved in China. The United States did not like this. They began to put more and more pressure on. Tensions had already been rising. I think the Anglo-Japanese alliance was ended in 1923. So there's more and more pressure. Japan, of course, completely dependent on foreign resources, by now got a very big war machine. It's got a big war on its hands in China. It needs fuel. It needs rubber. It needs raw materials. Otherwise, it cannot sustain this imperial enterprise. As the tensions rise, the U.S. is pushing. U.S. is not yet in the war. Americans were very much against getting into the war in 1940. Roosevelt actually did not want to make too much of a point that he really would wanted the Americans to get into the war. There was already the Lend-Lease program and the sharing of secret technology with the British and so on. There was a lot going on. They were de facto allies of the British, of the Roosevelt administration, but he ran for elections more ambiguously. And after elections, there was more and more pressure on the Japanese. The fleet was moved to Pearl Harbor in 1940, actually. I believe it was May or June. And the admiral in charge of the fleet, Admiral Kimmel, said in February, not a quote, that he felt this was a very vulnerable position for the U.S. fleet. His opinion was shared by many military people. It was not a surprise that Pearl Harbor should be a target, even though the date or the attack might have been a surprise. Pearl Harbor was known to be vulnerable, and the fleet was moved despite that. So what was the fleet doing there? The Pacific Ocean for 40 years had been a lake of competition, especially between the U.S. and Japan. But with Britain being a big player, because, you know, the British Empire and sun never sets and all that, you've heard that. British, of course, were all the way up to Malaya, as it was called then, Malaysia today. And the French were eastward of that in Vietnam. So in August 1941, so the U.S. was an oil exporter. Did you know the U.S. used to be an oil exporter? And the U.S. was an oil exporter, and Japan got most of its oil from the United States. In August 1941, the U.S. imposed an oil embargo on Japan. So now Japan, the Japanese imperialists, I should say, were stuck. Either they would have to give up the war, or they would have to go conquer some place that had oil. Does anybody know what that place would be?
Indonesia.
Indonesia, you're cheating. We've talked about this. Indonesia. Now, consider Indonesia. It's very surreal. So Indonesia at that time was a colony of the Dutch. And the Dutch at that time were occupied by Hitler. And the Americans had positioned the fleet to interdict the Japanese from going to get Indonesian oil, and the Japanese wanted Indonesian oil Did anybody think about the Indonesians? No. Okay. So I'm trying to open up the dialogue. I'll tell you a personal vignette. About 10 years ago, the International Criminal Court Treaty came into effect. I wasn't planning on saying this, but I was in the UN on that day when the 60th signature was deposited, and I was actually in that room. And I thought, it's a hopeful day when, in theory at least, still to be given some muscle, that the poorest peasant woman can be equal before a court of law with a sitting president of a country. In theory, we have the instrument. Just like Nuremberg, you know, victory for justice, in theory. We have the precedent. Good. So Japanese imperialists did not want to give up their imperial enterprise, and they had no other sure way of getting at Indonesian oil and holding it other than getting the U.S. fleet out of the way. Now you know a lot more about Pearl Harbor and what the U.S. fleet was doing there and why the Japanese bombed it. Now I can move on. So it was not a sneak attack in the sense that it was not known, Pearl Harbor, you know, this innocent fleet was sitting there, and some kind of crazy militarists who were prone to irrational violence came and bombed the fleet and killed more than 2,000 American sailors. Anyway, so the U.S. enters the war. Churchill is totally relieved. He really, really wanted the U.S. to enter the war. And Roosevelt was with him. He also wanted to enter the war. You could say this was a good or bad thing. You know, let's be clear. The Japanese militarists were violent imperialist murderers. They committed atrocities that killed millions of people. We cannot have a discussion about nuclear disarmament if we do not understand World War II, because we will never understand Hiroshima. So Churchill really wanted American help. At that time, the Soviet Union had already been attacked. So let me set a little bit more of the stage until the first decision to target Japanese forces. The Soviet Union Operation Barbarossa, June 22, 1941. So now, Germany, Soviet Union, at the time of Pearl Harbor, they've already been fighting for 6 months. So the Soviet Union, the United States, and Britain become allies. France is in that odd position. There's some resistance. But mainly Britain, U.S., and Soviet Union became allies from that time on. Now, the United States already had the whole anti-communist posture, as did Britain. They really did not want the Soviet Union in Europe. General Marshall, who was the head of the U.S. Armed Forces, he recommended, as did most other senior military officials, and I believe with them, I have some text in that regard, that the U.S. should invade Europe in 1942. I believe the suggested date was September. Churchill did not like. He wanted to make sure the Suez Canal was open. He insisted that the North African campaign be conducted first. 1943, it was the same thing. Meanwhile, Stalin and the Soviet Union are fighting the bulk of the war. Stalin is asking for help. He went so far as to tell the British that if you can't invade Europe from the West, at least send us some troops. You can come and fight on Soviet soil. He was inviting British troops to go and partly occupy Soviet soil to come and fight, and Churchill said no. So at the time of Operation Overlord, note the name, June 1944, the Americans were facing 27 divisions, 29 divisions, when the D-Day landings took place. And the Germans had 81 divisions in the West. on the Western Front. The Soviets were fighting 250 divisions, of which I believe 180-odd were German divisions. The rest were Eastern Europe, Romania, and so on. So that was the situation. Now the bomb project has started. Now we can insert the bomb project into this canvas. On October 9th, 1941, Vannevar Bush, how many have heard of Vannevar Bush? This is sad, because he is the principal architect of my story. He was the head of the office. He came from MIT, was an engineer, electrical engineer, and great inventor, very well established New England. He was a New England establishment man, like his colleague James Conant, who had been president of Harvard and a chemist. And Vannevar Bush was the head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development in Roosevelt's White House. He was in charge of the development of new technology for the war. Initially, I think he was not very sympathetic to this thing that, that Hitler will get the bomb. He had one goal, that the Pentagon does not have enough scientific resources for the United States. This is before the U.S. has entered the war now. This is 1940. U.S. should have more military muscle to be present as a dominant power on the world stage. This is his goal. He felt that academic scientists should be brought into this enterprise. Academic physicists were nowhere in the military enterprise in this country. They had been in Britain. From the Royal Society, and physicists were very close from the birth of the Royal Society. You can read Lewis Mumford about that. He has written wonderfully about this subject. But not here. By the end of 1940 or 41, I think half the physicists were already getting money from the Office of Scientific Research and Development. They had a pretty big budget, this office. Bush didn't like the idea of the Manhattan Project. It wasn't called that then. He didn't think that fission bombs would make it. He was finally convinced by people that this is serious. We cannot let Hitler get the bomb first. So he signed on. But it's my view. So you can develop your own view. I invite you to do so. And if you don't agree, I would like to know. But my view, that on October 9, 1941, when Bush, this is almost 2 months before Pearl Harbor now, we have started the what became the Manhattan Project. When Bush signed on to it, the use of the bomb was already decided, because his whole goal was that whatever he's going to spend a lot of money on has got to be used in this war. Fast forward, project has started. An executive committee was established for the Manhattan Project. Do you know that not a single general responsible for World War II was on this executive committee? Not one.
That was the first half of a one-hour talk by Arjun Makhijani.
Listen to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
1% want us atomized and divided. They want us in front of our TV sets and in front of our computer screens and our cell phones, once again, atomized and divided.
That's the voice of Bruce Dixon, managing editor of the Black Agenda Report. On this week's show, we speak to Bruce about Black Lives Matter, racism in America, and the current U.S. election cycle. So stay tuned. On the line, I have Bruce Dixon, a longtime activist and co-founder of the Black Agenda Report, and he is currently the managing editor. Hey, welcome to the show, Bruce.
Thanks for inviting me, Stuart.
Now, the visibility of the racial divide in America has never been so stark. We have Donald Trump talking about building walls, limiting immigration of Muslims, the emergence of the Black Lives Matter. Can you speak to the catalyst of this moment, and what was the catalyst for Black Lives Matter, and where are we right now?
Well, Black Lives Matter is, strictly speaking, is a hashtag, a slogan, and the people who came up with it were three black women, Opal Tometi, Alicia Garza, and Patrice Cullors, a couple of years ago. The thing about slogans and hashtags is that they can be adopted by anybody, and their content is often whatever you decide their content is. So there is an official Black Lives Matter network / organization, you know, that does exist. But nowadays, people are ascribing anything that black people, especially young black people, do as a product or outgrowth or outcome or production of Black Lives Matter. So it's kind of a fluid term that means, to some extent, whatever you want it to mean. And then again, it also means almost anything that young black people do that's political now is ascribed to Black Lives Matter, rightly or wrongly.
Recently at a Republican National Convention, they were saying, you know, Blue Lives Matter, and they were trying to link up these recent police killings to the Black Lives Matter movement. And I recently heard a commentary on one of these talk radio shows saying that they wish prosecutors would stop charging police because you're never going to get a conviction without third-party oversight. Your thoughts on the recent rash of shootings? You wrote an article about this that kind of counteracts some of the information that's out there.
Well, malicious authoritarians are always going to bend the news and bend reality to fit their quest for more power over the lives of ordinary people. So it's pretty much par for the course for malicious authoritarians, once again, including the representatives of police unions, politicians of both parties, public figures like Rudy Giuliani and such. It's perfectly normal for them to absolve in advance cops who murder and blame it on the broad public movement against police impunity and against police immunity from the laws that bind the rest of us against assault and murder. It's just par for the course. It's what malicious authoritarians do, is try to justify and expand their power to operate on behalf of the 1%.
Underneath this authoritarianism and this kind of police state that we're seeing is a military culture. Your article talks about the shooters in Baton Rouge and Dallas. Can you touch on that? And who were these shooters and what was their background?
Both the Dallas and the Baton Rouge shooter had backgrounds in the U.S. military. And both of them seem to have had, you know, similar, in some ways, psychological profiles, loners and such. It seems that this is something that they have in common with a lot of cops. We don't know what the percentage of military veterans among police is, because the U.S. Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics, does not keep that particular stat. It's a question they don't ask. You know, so the answer is kind of hard to come up with. But it's very likely that the percentage of military veterans among cops is as high or higher than any other profession you can name except Pentagon employees and employees of the Department of Homeland Security. And it's a known fact that in the military, in the U.S. military, seeking psychological help or admitting that you need psychological help is often the end of your career. It's frowned upon. The U.S. military is a twisted, wretched place where two out of every five women report being sexually assaulted during their military careers, and that may be an undercount. It's a place where reporting, not committing, but reporting those assaults can be the end of your military career. You know, and so this is the kind of world that our police come from, a large number of them. And it's the world that these two shooters also come from. And I think it's about time that we acknowledge that there's a link between the havoc and destruction that we sow overseas, using young men who were born and brought up here in the States, misusing their bodies, their energies, and their lives, and some of the mayhem and murder that goes on here on the streets of the U.S.
I'm on this news feed, and I get all this email regarding U.S. military operations. And today, for the first time in a long time, they showed a map of just U.S. bases in Africa and Southeast Asia. It's overwhelming, the size and scale of the U.S. military. But we have also seen the militarization of poor neighborhoods and military equipment on the streets of America. But you don't get them in rich neighborhoods in New York or San Francisco. It's mainly these poor neighborhoods, and it kind of becomes a new normal with deadly consequences. How do we stem this kind of military culture emerging into our streets? How do we stem that tide?
Well, if you've got a recent map of military bases in Asia and Africa, I wish you'd forward that one to me, because I could use that for some work I'm doing. Policing is the only realm in which government directly interferes with the lives of poor people. They've put police in the position of enforcing what we call a mass incarceration state. The United States right now leads the world in the number of people it locks up, and it locks people up longer and more often for things that are minor offenses everywhere else in the world, or not even offenses at all, worth prosecuting. And this kind of militarized law enforcement is always directed first and foremost at non-white people and at poor people. These are things that, as you remarked, you just don't see in rich neighborhoods, because that's not the way cops have learned and socialized each other and been permitted to do their job. They've been unleashed upon poor neighborhoods, which are supposedly filled with pathology and pathological actors and drugs and whatnot, and the war on drugs has been the excuse for disproportionate presence of law enforcement, this over-policing in black and brown and poor neighborhoods all over the country. And the military thing just goes with it. You've got a military-industrial complex, of course. The United States produces military equipment for half the armies in the world, probably. So it's no surprise that some of that equipment should wind up right here on our shores. It can't be a surprise. And there is an inextricable link, between the behaviors of our military and the behaviors of police and correctional officials here. It cannot have escaped anyone's notice that the rank-and-file torturers at Abu Ghraib were, in civilian life, Pennsylvania prison guards. You know, so these are connections which our media ought to be making, and these are connections which the psychological profession also ought to be making, but they're not.
It's incredible, and I want to touch on something you said, and that is, I was watching one of these Fox News debates about crime in the United States, and they had a former sergeant, and he said, well, black people are more likely to be shot because they commit most of the crimes in America, and look at the statistics. And the other guest quite rightly pointed out, he says, well, when you have all the road checks, when you have all the spot checks and all the random stop and frisks in poor neighborhoods, of course you're going to produce lopsided statistics. So you, it's about this culture of racism and that's within.
Yeah, what that gentleman was saying is that many of the crime stats are not crime stats at all. They are police activity stats. And so they measure the activity of police. And, you know, not the presence of crime. You know, if you've got a business here and low-wage workers, low-wage workers are cheated out of billions of dollars every month in the United States. Nobody ever goes to jail for that. So, and as a matter of fact, the amount of money people are cheated out of in wage theft is several times that stolen from people in robberies and burglaries in the United States. You know, so there's a crime wave. There's all kinds of crime waves going on, but you know, the police activity is what it is, and it's not necessarily about the crimes committed against poor people. It's the crimes that enable them to continue and justify the mass incarceration state and these malicious authoritarians.
I want to touch upon something that occurred to me. I was watching the RNC convention, and I'm like, who is this VP candidate, and what's why him? Which the mainstream media really hasn't asked. And then I realized, well, he's the governor of Senator Indiana, which is one of the worst regressive labor states in the union. And a lot of Ontario and Canadian jobs are moving to Indiana because of their anti-union law. So when you want to talk about low-paying jobs, you can see that Trump really chose the right man for the job. Do you have any thoughts about this man?
Yeah, he's Pence has tried to make Indiana a right-to-work state. Right-to-work is a concoction in U.S. law that basically says that unions are banned from being able to automatically enroll people and automatically collect dues, which makes it a little harder to organize unions. And contains some other provisions too, but the really really striking thing about that is that Thomas Kane, who's the Democratic VP candidate, is is not much different from Mike Pence on a lot of these wage issues.
Oh,
you know, he's the governor of a right to work state, and he has defended anti-union legislation, you know, himself. And Democrats are just not much better on labor questions, except rhetorically during election cycles. When it's not an election cycle, they may campaign a bit differently than Republicans, but they govern pretty much the same as Republicans. Canadians may remember back 8 years ago when Barack Obama was campaigning for president in the Democratic primaries, he would make appearances in places like Ohio and Indiana and talk about renegotiating NAFTA. And then at the same time, one of his operatives, the black former mayor of Houston, Texas, I think was the trade envoy to Canada, and he was quoted in the papers there as saying, oh, don't worry about him. He's got to say that. It's election season, and that's what the rubes have to hear. But don't worry, we're not going to renegotiate NAFTA.
You know.
So this is the way they are. And Mike Pence there's really not a great deal of space between the Republicans' vice presidential candidate and the Democrats' vice presidential candidate.
It makes me really sad to hear this, because we all have this illusion, and I think we spoke to Glenn Ford a couple of years ago, and he said that people have these fantasies, and then they attach it to Barack Obama, that he's going to do these great, amazing things, but a lot of it didn't materialize. Now, what on earth are Americans going to do? Because they can vote for, hold their nose and vote for Hillary, or they can vote for this kind of xenophobic monster to name Donald Trump. Where can people put this information, and how can they express themselves politically?
Well, I'm the co-chair of the Georgia Green Party. in my home state here. And, you know, we've worked to get our own presidential candidate, Dr. Jill Stein, on the ballot. And she's going to be in the ballot in at least 40 or 45 states, we believe. And so there will be alternatives for most Americans to cast a vote in some other direction, to cast a vote for a candidate who believes that we need to make a deliberate plan to get the heck off of fossil fuels, period, and transform our economy with a Green New Deal that, you know, creates real jobs for real people where they need to be, a party that opposes the bipartisan project of both parties in privatizing public education, a party that opposes war. Jill Stein is, in fact, the Green Party's Jill Stein is, in fact, the only anti-privatization candidate in the race. She's the only anti-war and peace candidate in the race. Even Bernie Sanders was saying that drones and drone warfare was a good idea. You know, so and Bernie Sanders also has been known to say that we ought to really step up our arming of our surrogate powers, you know, like Saudi Arabia. You know, so you know, people do have alternatives in some cases, and we have to work harder to make those alternatives available to more people.
If I make this argument, people might listen to this when they listen to this, and they'll say, "Come on, Bruce, all you're doing is electing Trump because the progressive vote will just disappear, and we will have to put up with Trump. Surely the Democrats have some more progressive policies than the Republicans, and I can't throw my vote away." So how would you respond to people like that?
A vote cast in fear is a vote thrown away. If your vote means anything, then nobody should be able to scare you or blackmail you into voting for what you don't want. Eugene Debs used to say that he'd rather vote for what he did want and not get it than vote for what he didn't want and get that. When you vote for Hillary Clinton, you're voting for a real warmonger who really has experience at doing, at overthrowing governments, at starting wars, and who tells much better lies than Mr. Trump does. You're voting for somebody who actually has experience doing these devilish things. You're voting for someone who was instrumental in overthrowing the elected government of a country on the borders of Russia, on the borders of nuclear-armed Russia, and arming and financing neo-Nazi groups in the Ukraine to wreak havoc in parts of that place, and you know, which has pushed U.S. Military bases, NATO bases, like I said, to the borders of Russia. This is not a small thing. It really seems that while Republicans talk more evil, Democrats are often able to do more evil. NAFTA was not passed under a Republican president. NAFTA came up and failed twice under the first President Bush. And then when Clinton was elected, Clinton rallied enough congressional Democrats behind it to pass it. All right. George Bush also could not have done the so-called welfare reform that, you know, decimated families and threw huge numbers of people onto the low-wage market without child care. George Bush couldn't have done that. Only Clinton could have done it, and Clinton did do it. When Barack Obama came into office, the U.S. was only in a handful of African countries. Now we've got bases throughout the African continent. We're flying drone missions out of Mali, and we're, you know, bombing people in Somalia and any number of other places. We're flying drone missions over the Congo now. You know, so Barack has been able to do things that a Republican president could not do, would have been protested against it and blocked. But the fact that he's a Democrat has made him the more effective evil. Not the lesser evil, but the more effective evil.
I can feel a lot of depressed people hearing this. And also, you know, as just as a point in Canada, it was a conservative government that signed off on NAFTA, and the oppositional party said, when we get in power, we're going to repeal it, and it never got repealed. So I guess...
Yeah, good luck with that.
We're getting lied to all the time. Now, for people who are listening at home and they can see the state of racism and the daily news and who just feel kind of hopeless, what advice do you give to ordinary people to kind of resist and to kind of take their own agency and their own communities back?
Unhook yourselves from the TV and unhook yourselves even from some of your social media and talk to your own neighbors. Talk to your own neighbors. Don't confine your activism to collectivism. If you're going to build the kind of world you want, you've got to start right next to you, and you've got to start making common cause with your neighbors. And that's where everything starts. If you can't organize in the community and the workplace and the church and where you live and go to school, then what's it all about? What's it all about? The 1% want us atomized and divided. They want us in front of our TV sets and in front of our computer screens and our cell phones, once again, atomized and divided. We need to make human connections and put some skin in the game. We've got to operate more in meat space and less in cyberspace, I think.
Well, put in just as an example, here in BC, we've had a terrible housing crisis. Like, literally, like 90% of the population can't afford to buy a home here, and there's so much foreign investment flipping homes that over the last 2 years, we've seen a lot of the home renovations. So people started squatting in properties, and people have started protesting, and now they're talking about adding more taxes and taking action on this issue. But it didn't come out of anywhere. It didn't just come out of the goodwill of the politicians. It came out of a lot of people kind of resisting.
That's the way capitalism works. Under capitalism, no neighborhood of poor people is safe, because the only value that a neighborhood of poor people has is the value that can be realized by flipping it. Because capitalism, under capitalism, they measure economic health by property values. You see? And so then, you know, when blacks and minorities buy into a neighborhood, they automatically lower the property values, you see? And like I said, the only value that a working-class neighborhood, a poor neighborhood has, is the value that you can realize by driving those people out and gentrifying it. So the only solution to that is, just as you say, not an individual solution, but a collective solution. Organizing your neighborhoods and taking collective action and demanding property and the right to a home, the right to a place to live, be handled by something other than the so-called free market.
Exactly. I guess the latest stats said there's 10,000 empty homes in Vancouver, empty condos, and less than 1% vacancy rate. So literally people are being squeezed out. Now I'm coming to the end. Please tell people how they can find your articles and the Black Agenda Report, and also any final comments about this moment of time, this moment in history.
You can find Black Agenda Report on the web at www.blackagendareport.com. And we've been publishing every week for 10 years now, almost 11 years. And we are one of the key voices in the United States of the black left. And we're living through an historic time here when both of the two major parties are basically destroying themselves. And if we're lucky, very soon there will be no Republican Party and there will be no Democratic Party as we know it. And that's when things actually change, is when there are upheavals and some of these parties get dissolved. The last time a political party dissolved in the United States, I think, was the Civil War 140 years ago. These are massive realignments that have the potential for massive change. And so we may be living through one of those moments. So it is time, once again, like I said, to detach a little bit from your media connections and your social media, and get with your neighbors and talk to your neighbors and organize something in meat space, not cyberspace.
Thank you so much for taking the time on short notice to do this interview, and hopefully we'll speak soon.
Thank you.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.